This episode of Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers, with info on over 50,000 console, handheld, iOS, and PC games. Get the Gamefly app for free today on your iPhone, iPad, and Android devices.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Weekend Confirmed.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Weekend Confirmed. This is Garnet Lee, and I am really stoked. Well, I should say I was really stoked for today's show because Dan's here, and always it seems like Jeff brings in, you know, Dan and Alex when I'm not here and plays like this little game so that, you know, I can't see everybody at the same time. But then Jeff launched his Kickstarter this week, and he's so successful, he's just like, you know what? Screw you guys. I don't need this shit anymore. We can confirm. Confirm this, bitches. And that was it. So, you know, guess we're not friends anymore because he's, you know, counting his stacks.
I think one of the stretch goals was to never be on Weekend Confirmed.
Right.
Never.
He's like, see you later, suckers.
Yeah, we should mention Jeff's Kickstarter specifically saying if anyone, I mean, people know about it because he's been really successful with it so far, but Kickstarter.com, and you can search for his name. And holy crap, he's doing a new show, but
awesome.
He's not leaving Weekend. I mean, he's, you know.
No, he's totally leaving. Yeah, yeah. He called up Dave. He was like, screw you guys. He's often like, he's already in Hawaii, like counting his money or something.
Yeah, didn't he just buy like a Rolls Royce?
I think so.
Yeah, that was a stretch goal.
I think so.
But yeah, he's doing this new show and you can help support it. And yeah, amazing so far. He's raised quite a bit of money. So
anyway, you actually should totally support Jeff. He's calling it Team
2N1
Team. 2N1 Team, which is freaking awesome, and it's on Kickstarter. We'll have a link in the show notes. And it's actually Del Rio's fault that Jeff's not here because Jeff's been up in San Francisco traveling, and he's like, well, Jeff's supposed to be here like a little while ago. He's like, calls him up, and Jeff was at the airport like waiting for his flight. He's like, yeah, I'm gonna be there this evening, we're gonna tape tonight, right?
I thought I was his replacement. I assumed that he wasn't gonna be here, but I can never.
I have to say that the name really confuses me because I'm not sure if either of you are big K-pop listeners, but there's 2NE1, which is a really big K-pop girl group, and every time I see that, I'm like,
now there's a stretch goal for Jeff.
Yes, to compete with 2NE1's K-pop status.
He should really make a K-pop music video.
He should totally make a K-pop.
That should be
the stretch goal.
There we go.
Holy crap.
That is an amazing stretch goal. All right. I endorse this.
I'll direct it. I'll direct his video.
I'll cameo in it. I can be like the dude who comes up in the parking lot in the yellow suit.
Nice.
Yeah, and we already have a volunteer from Del Rio to make the beats for it. This is awesome. Awesome idea coming together already here.
I think it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Or we'll launch a Kickstarter just for that.
Jeez, when Jeff's not here, you guys really come up with great ideas.
I know. It's like the creative energy sap is no longer gone.
Yeah.
Just all flowing out. By the way, I should also introduce Andrew Yoon here from Shaq News. And I don't know. You've been around traveling as well.
Yeah, honestly, I don't think this is weird not being in a plane. I'm so grounded.
Well, you're gonna have to take off your headphones and turn off electronical devices before
electronical?
Electronical. We will be
that's what they say, right?
Electronical, yes.
Yeah, I exclusively fly Southwest, that's why.
God.
Have you ever been on those Southwest flights, by the way, where they like feel like they have to do something really clever and funny with the announcements?
I don't think
they do it nearly as often as they used
to. I've never flown.
Virgin does stuff like that. Virgin gets funky with their...
It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
All right. So what do we got on today's show? Oh, by the way, before we go anywhere further, I want to give a special thank you to Ian Nitram, or Nitram, whichever way you pronounce your name. He gave us a little Shaq News chatty-style intervention on the show thread last week. So good on you, Ian. It was a very, very good reminder not to get too wrapped up in the negative comments and to do what the hell we do. So fuck it. We are going ahead. Warp Factor 9. And if something gets in the way, well, we'll just, you know, I don't know, die in a singularity or something. It'll be awesome. It'll be awesome on the way, though. Be fantastic. We have lots of stuff on the show today. We have, so I made a decision this week, at the beginning of the week, to go with SimCity because I knew like SimCity, Tomb Raider are both coming out. And I thought, well, there's a lot of stuff on Tomb Raider. There's a lot of positive buzz around that. And I want to get my mind right about, you know, playing the game for what it is and not... So you guys all know who listen And I don't know if you'd follow this, Danny, but I'm like a huge Tomb Raider fan. I'm a huge, huge, huge Tomb Raider fan. And ever since seeing this Tomb Raider, I've just been having this internal conflict between, okay, they're making a cool game and it's new, and I still love Tomb Raider where Tomb Raider was. And I especially love what Crystal D did when they took over for Core. I think they did a great job of really embodying like everything that Core's Tomb Raider originally had been.
Was that the very last one?
The last three.
Okay. Yeah.
The last three. And the first of which was the first time they brought back Toby Gard from the original game's design. And like, I just think that they really got it right and had a lot of fun with it. And I appreciate everything I've heard about this Tomb Raider. You've been playing it, so we'll hear about that. Dan's actually been playing it on PC. So you know, this is the PC Elitist podcast, by the way. You know.
Oh, it's bizarre that you would describe me as that, because I'm just only barely getting into PCs. And
I mean, when I don't see active tessellation happening or...
I don't even know
to turn that off because I have a 600 series NVIDIA card, and with Tomb Raider, there's a bug.
Too many tessellators?
Yeah, there's like, or the tess effects, the hair effects.
Oh, so what, you're playing it with just standard hair, not even dynamic hair?
Everything else is ultra except the hair.
I just want to vomit all over you right now.
Anyway, so I got into SimCity, and we're going to talk about that because it's been a disaster, as everybody who's been on the internet today can attest to. Whereas sort of two dialogues to have there, one on the game and then one on the whole state of like digital e-commerce and games. And as folks have pointed out, not only just what it means for always on games, but what it means for, you know, the rumors still floating around that the next Xbox would be a always on connected system. They wouldn't be using exact same sort of system, but, you know, there's still a number of pitfalls to these sorts of systems. And one of the reasons that I haven't been completely worried about what's going on with that. And Andrew, you didn't write down what you've been playing, so I figured you've been playing some games. I don't know what they are.
Actually, you know, I haven't really been playing games. I've been seeing a lot of demos and, you know, talking to people about games. I haven't really been playing anything.
So you have some stuff to share, though, at least.
I'm probably just going to talk about F-Zero GX. You know, so what? It's like 7 years old.
So we're going to have a weird combination. You're going to talk about F-Zero GX, and then we're going to be Tomb Raider. Dan also wants to talk about Dark Souls because he's up to like 200 hours in the game. All right, so we'll tear right into it. Maybe I'll talk about Ni No Kuni 2 since I'm getting close to the end of that.
I haven't started it. I have it sitting. My wife is a massive Miyazaki fan, but she's not a video game person. So
you have to play it for her.
We're gonna do it. I will not play a second without her by my side. And I asked her to drive, but she's like, I'm gonna, you know, walk into walls and stuff. So I will drive it, but we are doing it together.
Oh, you're gonna love
it.
You're gonna really love it.
I don't think Miyazaki has any involvement. It's just Ghibli, right?
It's his namesake.
I don't think he
still reflects
his aesthetic, and
it reflects the aesthetic very well, because you have both the art style, right, but you also have the music and the sort of childlike wonder of it, but still being very appealing to mature
it's
audience.
Like if a movie is not directed by J.J. Abrams, yet it's produced by Bad Robot, I still expect a certain quality. We all love Cloverfield. He didn't direct Cloverfield, but we still attributed that to J.J. and Lost and all that stuff. So I think, you know, Kuni represents the Miyazaki.
An alias.
Well, he did the pilot, but yeah.
Actually, did you ever hear about how they were going to end Alias?
I never finished it, but I heard that it didn't end well anyway.
Well, how he wanted to end it apparently was the show that he worked on before Alias was Felicity.
Right.
And so he wanted to just have like, after the final scene, the camera pans out and Felicity's writing in her journal.
Oh my god.
She's just like, and that was my book, Alias.
There's no way that would have been a disaster. That is kind of rad, though.
I think it would have been. Really?
I mean, in a funny way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just badass to just say, put your flag in the ground and be like, that's how we're doing the end of this show.
I mean,
that'd be crazy.
I think all of the Abrams properties have been connected in some way or another. Like, the Cloverfield monster is like the product of like...
Well, Slusho, totally.
So one day we'll be able to tie all these threads together.
So eventually, when he directs Star Wars, it will have some kind of tie into
It'll be the midichondrians. that'll be
or the midichlorians.
Midichlorians, whatever they are.
Pushing my glasses and correct you, but
sorry, no, that's fine. I always make that mistake. You see, it's first mistake of the show, and not even 5 minutes in. That's the way it should be.
That is the
way it should be. You're gonna love Ni No Kuni. It's so good, dude. It's so good. And the two things to be wary of is that you need to go into the mindset of I'm gonna play all of the side quest stuff. lest you fall into the routine of grinding. So you'll get into it, and there's a system in the game, much like there are in many Japanese role-playing games, where there's a errands board and then also bounty hunts, and you should do both of them every time you get them. Okay. Because that'll help level you up and keep you like in the progression system. And the other thing is, be ready that there are some, like, the combat system, it's actually pretty, it's pretty tough.
Okay.
It's an active...
Tough to know or tough to master?
Just tough to keep up with at times, because it's an active battle system, and your characters are all... Your character, along with your two AI partners, eventually are all moving in the space, and you need to kind of keep the camera moving so you can see what's in front of you and what you're locked onto and what you're attacking.
Oh, wow.
And be quick with responses. So if, like, you see an attack coming, you want to get to defend very quickly. You also need to see your holes for where you can launch your attacks and your spells pretty quickly.
Got it.
And you do actually have to do a lot of, you know, there's a lot of combat management. There's a lot of game to manage in the game.
Interesting.
Which I think might have surprised people who looked at it as like, oh, it looks like a kid's game, because it's not exactly just a kid's game. So if you do those things, you'll be in great shape. And just be prepared. I mean, I got to a bit of a, I'm at the march to the very end of it. And right before there, I hit a boss who was really messing me up. And it was because I needed to go back and just do, like, I still had like two bounty hunts to do on an errand, and I went and ran those and did that, and I got like another level and a half. I was like, oh, okay, well, now I'm okay.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. It's post Dark Souls, I approach every game differently now in terms of leveling and because
I guess so.
I have a new set of skills now from that game, and the way that I react to game design, and through Dark Souls, I've finished the game as a high level character, but I've also halfway through finishing the game as a soul level one character. So there's an interesting idea in that you just need skill to win a match. You don't need level, which now sounds, thinking about a game like Ni No Kuni, which is like, oh yeah, in other games, it doesn't come down to your skill. It comes down to, do you have the hit points to withstand
enough battle.
So
you think that no thinking to it, I did not understand this. Let me make sure I understand this correctly.
Yeah.
There's a mode in Dark Souls where you play a weakened character.
Well, it's not even a mode. It's the way that game operates is it's so, and this is what drew me to it. I was playing a lot of Terra, the MMO that Jeff, Alex, and I were playing. Oh yeah, and did you not start or no?
I have it. I was going
to
go back to it. I got my email from them that was like, you played for the first month, so come back.
Right. But as what happens a lot of times with me when I play a lot of video games, and specifically MMOs, where games that I don't have a lot of control over, I start to crave a more hands-on combat system. In general, and it was before Devil May Cry had come out. I was kind of anxious for that. And I was like, let me tap back into Dark Souls. Let me just see what that's like. And boy, oh boy, the combat system in that game is beautiful. It is so simple. It's simple yet deep. And the fact that one trigger is your sword, one trigger is your shield. However, you have many different sizes to swords. You have many different sizes to shields. You can have a shield that has quick regen of your stamina because you have a stamina bar in the game. But has very little deflection, so you can take hits more. So you then have to play as I roll around a lot, or you can have a very heavy shield and you're very slow, but you can withstand those hits. And, you know, so all that affects your gameplay. But you can always level. You can be a soul level one, a level one character, and level up all of your stuff, so you still can deliver the hit points. You just can't F up. You just can't get hit because you're. Your health points haven't been leveling up. That's what really takes a toll on. So if you have the skill, you can conquer that game. You just have to not screw up a block, not screw up an attack, and it's all based on timing. It's all based on your actual physical dexterity and the pattern recognition that you've acquired, or just...
How does that speak to you? Because I think the problem with Dark... I appreciated how fun... I played Dark Souls for a little while.
Yeah.
Clearly not enough. But I really enjoyed the combat system, but I don't have the patience for it. I mean, maybe I just have adult ADD or whatever, but...
Well, I'll tell you what helped a lot. Before diving back in, I watched a Let's Play on YouTube by this guy named Northern Lion. And he is a very funny, charming guy. And when he's playing the game, he has this commentary that made it fun to watch. And one of the things he said was, you don't need to worry about losing your souls, which I think is the turnoff, or the death penalty in the game is what's very scary and intimidating for a lot of people, because you don't want to spend so much time playing and then lose.
But then you always have to go back and get them. Why do you not have to worry about them?
Because you always get a poop. As long as you keep playing, once you kill the boss, you'll get a poop ton of souls and you'll be back at a bonfire and you can level. You know, you never need to freak out about, oh my, I lost that 1,000. It's all good. And by the way, leveling doesn't matter, right? It's really about leveling up through item collecting, through killing bad guys, or purchasing at merchants, stuff to upgrade your armor and your gear. That's what's really more important. So, so that took a lot of the weight and the intimidation off of my shoulders, and I was really able to embrace the game. And there's this other beautiful thing in the game that I didn't get my first playthrough, which was the online, the multiplayer component of
right.
it, which is like, I mean, when I played Journey, not only was it my favorite game, you know, up there,
but mine too.
But I think the exciting thing was, what if we had this kind of mechanic in a more traditional game? And I was, it's freaking Dark Souls. Like, there's two components. There's the antagonism, there's the PvP, and then there's right. the summoning, there's the co-op, right? And the way that that works is, if you're human in the game, because you play a lot as an undead, but when you humanize, you see summon signs. And you can see NPCs, you can get a computer guy to help you beat a boss or go through the level, or you can get another player. And I play with a buddy of mine. We timed our summonings to, you know, you have to be around the same level range to see them. But if not, you'll summon a random dude, and he might not know where you're going, and he might not be helpful. He might be super helpful. He might give you a sweet item that's awesome, and he might show you a secret path that you didn't know about, that if you go down there, you get this other awesome piece of gear, which is so precious in a game like Dark Souls. And it's this amazing emergent gameplay. Like Journey, it's like, wow, I just like went through this experience where I took down this enormous boss in this game that's revered as the most difficult thing, whatever. And I did it with this random dude who I never, and you have gestures in the game.
Right.
So you have these, you bow to each other. That's, which is even great in the PvP. There's sort of this accepted communal, because, and by the way, also very helpful is the wiki, which I know you're a fan of, Garnet. There's the wiki dot or whatever for Dark Souls that tells you all about all the deep stuff that is very helpful to play the game, the covenants and item and items and weapons and things like that. But there's sort of this communal accepted level range to be in PvP and kind of an honor code, and people generally adhere to that. When you get summoned into, when you're invading someone's world, you know, you battle each other, you put your buffs on your weapons, and then you go to town. And by the way, that PvP, it's not like a fighting game where you have to know the combo system. You have to memorize, you know, down to right, A, B does my Hadouken. And you know what I mean? You have to know all those things. It's like, once again, it's left is shield, right is sword, and there are spells as well. But that's basically it. You can survive if you're way under leveled compared to the other guy. You can pull it off if you have the skill. And that's what's, and it's all based on like fencing. It's sort of like this great sword fighting simulator that I've always wanted. Because it's not, it to me, it's what my imagination of sword fighting in movies is. Like, I hate it when a fight sequence in a movie is overly choreographed and everyone, it's a dance and they all kind of know what each other are doing. I love it when I'm on their journey with somebody, you know, when I feel like I'm with the character. It's like, yeah, I would have like Jason Bourne. Oh, he sees the pen and he grabs the pen and he, you know, it's like, yeah, that seems like the smart thing to do. By the way, there's nothing like that in Dark Souls, but it's the idea of like, this is really what combat would be like. It's not,
you're in the moment. It's very much of the instance of the moment, because you're not trying to say there's no rock, paper, scissors. There's I know what this attack was. I need to defeat it with this attack, and then I can punish if he does this. It's all about like what openings are left because of how they moved. And that's where I get into trouble is that you need to be patient, as you mm-hmm. would in this sort of fight.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like a point in time where I'll be going back and forth, and at some point in time, I'll get just that little bit of too impatient and try to put in an attack when I shouldn't have. And then that's it.
I mean, that happens in every game though, right? I mean,
I don't know. In most games though, they're so cushioned with recovery concepts.
That's true.
Whether they be recovery items or ways that you can get back out of stuff, or just that there's not a huge penalty to it.
Dark Souls has that stuff too, though. Gotta say, there's things like that. There's a ring that you can find, which, by the way, that's what's great, is like, if you know about it, if you've read about it on the forum or whatever, you can go deep into Blighttown and get a ring, or in the depths, actually, if I'm going to nerd out and be specific. You go into the depths and get the Ring of Evil Eye that increases your hit points. So if you're a guy who dies a lot or whatever, your hit points will increase without having to take either use a healing spell or an Estus or a vial. Yeah, exactly. So if that's the guy you are and you need more help with your vitality, you can go into the depth, wander in, and have that adventure to get that item that you can use.
That is kind of cool. But,
and you talk about that. It's like,
game doesn't teach you about that, right?
That's true. That and I get that being very off-putting to people. Yet for me, it's challenged me because the game doesn't offer that I've wanted to seek out more. I mean, I don't know if you've ever gotten that way about like a TV show or maybe another video game where. And it usually happens with MMOs because MMOs generally don't teach it. You would never want to run an MMO and just, you would never be able to figure out the crafting system of without reading about it online or having a buddy who's in the guild or whatever explain to you, this is how raids work. You need to be there. I mean, that's how that kind of game works. And Dark Souls operates that way. It just isn't of that genre, so you don't expect it to operate that way. But once you do find out those places, that to me is what's so fun. Like, I'll give you another, for instance, that there's, interpreted in a different way. I'm playing a lot of Tomb Raider, and in games like Tomb Raider, there's moments where you have to travel across a narrow space, and the camera will go vertical, bird's eye view, looking down, and you have the typical
wobble balancing
thing. Dark Souls, there are times where you have to traverse very narrow terrain, and it doesn't then enter in a new way of controlling your character. It is the way you're walking around the world. Suddenly you're walking around this precarious place in the same way you were before, and it's now just very like the same set of skills you have from the beginning. You're always operating in that way. So now when I'm operating on a very narrow piece of ground, it's like, am I still able to use those skills to? And then, by the way, they throw enemies at you. What I mean, there's moments where in this game where you're like, is it really doing this right now? Do I really have to accomplish that? You know, suddenly, not only am I doing a thing that I thought was impossible just to navigate, now I have to fight while being in this precarious place. I mean, but when you do, it doesn't feel like I beat a level in Uncharted or Assassins or finished an area of Journey or any other game. It feels like an actual accomplishment. I feel like I'm not an athlete. But as a kid, you know, playing soccer, whatever, but athletes can relate to when you win a game, when you feel like I have a physical accomplishment because I had a thick, intense adrenaline rush. Well, and then you have the relief of that. I mean, it is.
I think there is definitely a universal agreement about that on Dark Souls.
Yeah.
And its predecessor is that is the thing that got people is like it was, yes, it was a very high threshold to accomplish. And then because it was such a high threshold, once you did, you felt really satisfied for getting there.
Yeah.
I just don't know how applicable that can be to all games.
Yes. But that's what makes it special. Is that just like a lot of the experience of games like Journey or Braid or those one of a kind games, they're one of a kind. You know, like not all games should be the way. I do think the death penalty of Dark Souls that isn't as bad as everyone says, but it being a bit more severe does create that tension. And I mean, the multiplayer could be refined because it really is designed to be like Journey where you shouldn't know anyone. And I've had to break the game a little bit to play
it
with a specific friend. Yeah, I wish there was a way that was easier for future Dark Souls games, but I would love to see in all other games, specifically adventure games, incorporating co-op in that very, more in that Journey way, more in that minimalist.
Well, we're clearly seeing, I think we're definitely going to see a lot more of that. You know, Activision has that Bungie game coming out, Destiny, and you know, it's all about that. You know?
Spontaneous multiplayer.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea that Arkane was working on with The Crossing, which looked so very cool, which to me is still like one of the greatest disappointments in design in the last few years is that didn't ever come to fruition. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but Arkane was working on this game called The Crossing. Sarcane is the studio that wound up doing Dishonored.
Right?
Right. Okay. So prior to that, they were working on this game called The Crossing, and long story short is it had this Knights Templar sort of thing going on it as well, and you would, while you were playing your single-player campaign, other folks who were playing online and perhaps didn't have time or wanted, or maybe they just wanted to play the other side, could drop in to someone's single-player campaign in the AI enemy roles. So you would have live players in those roles. And of course, they would be much like Valve's worked a lot on the balancing of this in Left 4 Dead 2, where, you know, there's certainly a balancing equation there between the people who are on the quest versus the zombies. You have to really figure out, okay, how do we balance this so that it is attainable, no matter how, you know, attainable within reason for both sides to be successful, and yet still have like this asymmetrical balance? Because that's really, I mean, it's all about this asymmetric balance, and that's like really tough to pull off.
And that's why Wii U is going to be the best-selling system of all time.
Because it's in-room asymmetric gameplay?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, even Resident Evil 6 tried that. You know, they had a lot of, you know, they had that, like, mode where
you had
four-player co-op modes. They had, like, play as the enemy mode. You know, they
were talking about the crossover
stuff.
Segments.
Yeah, they did the crossover. They also, you know, there was also that mode where you could jump.
And you just didn't. I mean, you didn't honestly really know when you were playing whether or not you crossed, whether someone actually crossed over and played with you at the same time, or if you were just with the AI. I mean, I suppose if you played it through enough times, you'd be able to recognize. But still, everything again becomes dynamic, and the AI is going to respond the way it would, and a person's going to respond they would, and hopefully, you're all working together.
And, you know, and that's operating under, like, current gen, like, network restrictions, mm-hmm. you know, with all the Xbox Live and PlayStation Network policies. You know, imagine, like, how much more ambitious that's going to get in the next generation of console design, you know? Mm.
Well, I think that, though, Dan, the one thing about your experience with Dark Souls is, like, you want to play with your friends, right?
Yeah.
But if the designer had given you the ability to create games, would you ever have had the spontaneous experiences? I mean, I don't know. That's a rhetorical question, I guess, to agree, because you can't. It's hard to say. But the thing is, you have that natural, I want to play with my friends, so I'm going to default to playing with my friends. Whereas not offering that at all, even though you gamed it, means that if you want to go in and play and you turn it on and you just play, then it'll be playing in that way.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, Genova Chen talked about with Journey, because one of the things they faced was, just when they were trying to design the multiplayer component of it, it was so hard for them to figure out how to overcome the, you know, these impulses for people to do crappy things to each other. Mm-hmm. They're really interesting. Was that the interview that we did in the magazine that I'm thinking of, or did he do that with us before that?
It's probably before that. For us, we were really focusing on their studio, after Journey, you know, not really so much the process of making Journey, but what they're doing after.
But it was really interesting. And then talking about, you know, the limits of player engagement and how they handled all of it. And of course, that's why at no time, like, no matter how you play Journey, you're not going to know who you played with.
Yeah.
And people are all like, oh, I can't believe that. I want to know who I played with.
Well, at the end. Right. Know.
But I mean, like, spontaneously through the...
Right.
Because you're like, oh, I want to know who that is. And then I just think that was really genius. I think that was really smart, and it was controversial at the time, but now as we look back on it, it really seems to have been one of the parts that really, really clicked and was inspired.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although, in Dark Souls, because it's all Xbox gamer tags, and then you can go into your friends, so you'll help someone, they'll give you, or you'll be a dick to them, and they'll send you a message that's very hateful, or they'll send you a very helpful message.
Oh, like, so you do see
it. Hey, you see their gamer tag. You don't, I mean, it's...
You're supposed to play that game on PlayStation 3, by the way. Don't you know the rules?
Yeah. I actually regret, because I think there's a more lively community still playing it. I mean, I'm having no problem playing PvP now, but I would imagine it would be even easier if I was playing on PS3. But...
Just because it came up as a PlayStation game.
Right.
Originally.
And in Japan, I think people are still kind of pretty active on it.
So. Oh, yeah, I would think so. Yeah. It's super popular. I mean, still, obviously, you know, in the core communities, both on Shaq and on NeoGAF, still a ton of people swear by that game. And obviously, it's going to be a huge influence on multiplayer design, as will Journey, over the next, you know, 2 or 3 years. All right, so that was a good sidetrack. When we come back, that was a good way to not talk about SimCity off the bat. We had really exciting, positive stuff.
SimCity's fans are used to it. You know, they're like, oh, man, they're going to talk about SimCity. I'm going to see SimCity 30 minutes later.
That's right.
Sorry. We'll get around to that.
So if you've been queuing for the SimCity talk, give us a second. We'll reboot that conversation and come right back with that.
Sure, you can pay $60 if you want to play a video game. But what if you want to play all the latest video games? Try Gamefly.com, the number one video game rental service. Right now, you can sign up for just $5.95, their lowest price ever. Gamefly has over 8,000 titles, including the hottest new releases like DMC Devil May Cry, The Walking Dead, and Hitman Absolution. And here's how easy it is. Just sign up, select your games, and Gamefly will ship them directly to your door. You can keep the games as long as you want, there are no late fees, and you can cancel at any time. Once you're done playing a game, send it back, and Gamefly will send you the next available game on your list. Now, you can also play hundreds of PC games with Gamefly's new Unlimited PC Play, which is free for members. Gamefly also saves you money by letting you try your favorite games before buying them. If you really like the game you're playing, simply click Keep It on the Gamefly website, and it's yours at a deeply discounted price. And if you're still unsure, which you shouldn't be at this point, but if you're still unsure, we're offering our listeners a special offer. This is just for Weekend Confirmers. Go to gamefly.com/weekendconfirmed for an extended 15-day free trial. That's gamefly.com/weekendconfirmed and sign up today.
I love talking about Dark Souls because it always brings up the best conversations. So we were just talking about it in the break, and we were talking about it being old school, and Dan was trying to twist my arm and convince me to play it again. So, yeah, I'll totally cop to this. Like, I've tried to play it twice. The second time was much more successful. The first time I tried to play it, I didn't read anything ahead of time, and I, like, got down in the main campfire after, like, so you have, like, there's an intro area, right, then you get to the main campfire.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but I wound up going down.
Oh, to the skeletons.
Yes.
The death. Yeah, and, murder. Murder alley.
And I, like, looked around twice and I did not, for whatever reason, I didn't see the passage that went up to the aqueduct. So I was like, okay, I guess I'm supposed to beat, I mean, I know the reputation of the game, I'm supposed to beat these skeletons. I will beat these skeletons. And I could not beat those skeletons for anything. And then there's, like, then I've, like, found another staircase, and this staircase goes down to, like, some dark misty land. I was like, okay, maybe that's what I'm supposed to do.
No, that is
not what you're supposed to do at all, because I really got my head handed to me there. I was, like, frustrated as hell with it then. So that was fine. And then I was like, put it down for a little while, and I came back, and I started playing it again. I'm like, okay, this is pretty fun. I was having a good time. Now I knew where to go. I had read up a little bit, and I could make it through the aqueducts and all that kind of stuff. I tried to fight the Black Knight guy who's like in the little down passage.
Yep, Undead Berg. Yep.
Couldn't beat him for anything.
Yep.
Which, like, is that a yep, as I'm not supposed to be able to beat him?
No, I mean, he's very challenging. If you had become human, you could have summoned help from another player probably at that point, and he would have been no problem, and you could have gone fought an even more challenging night, and then the boss. But
I think in grand total, I may have been human twice. It was really hard.
But
to get
by the
human.
Way, I played Demon's Souls a little bit before. I didn't know anything about being. I didn't get that. I figured the game will teach me, and that's the thing. It's not that game. I'm not recommending you just go home and play it, and hopefully you'll figure it out. It is not the design. The game is to be played with. I think what's the cool of it. It's like kind of like Dungeons & Dragons, pen and paper Dungeons & Dragons. It's like the point of this game, it's encouraging you to look at the community online or call up a buddy who's played it and be like, hey, I went to these skeletons and I got my ass kicked. Like, am I doing this right? I know this is a really hard game. And they go, no, you got to go up through, you know, into Undead Berg and fight the Black Knight on the, you know, and like just that conversation. To me, what I love about that is that it syncs up with the experience of playing the game, right? You're an adventurer. And you had to talk to a fellow adventurer about where to go. And it's like, suddenly you're like,
it takes the game out of the game.
Yeah.
I get it. No,
like,
I get
that's
it.
That's a fun thing. So call me up, tweet me, and I'll be like, I made a buddy on Twitter. I was tweeting about Dark Souls, and I was like, dude, should I get this item, or is it better to fight with this or with that? And we had this huge conversation. His name's Alex Hanley. I email him every night. I'm like, hey, dude, what do you think? Should I do this? And it's like, it's awesome that is a part of the playing of the game. But it's very classic Nintendo. You know, it's very like in those Nintendo games, unless you called that the cheat,
the 1-900 number.
Yeah, the 900 number, which I never did and always wanted to. Those games didn't really inform you how to play. And by the way, I prefer games. I love game design that really tells you what to do without having to read. We don't read instruction booklets anymore, right?
Well, I mean, the.
Please.
But Dark Souls is a separate. Well, I shouldn't say that. This is a separate thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think every game should be that way. But It's cool that that exists.
Well, I mean, it must be really frustrating when you just start Dark Souls and you're like the first guy and that community isn't there and you're just like, what the hell is going on?
Although, for some people, I think being that Vanguard would be something they loved.
As I said, there'd be badasses. Like,
they'd be like,
figure it out.
I love this. I'm the one.
I have a question for you, though. Did you ever really get back into Metal Gear Rising? Because obviously, that game,
I finished it.
That game had the same problem where it doesn't teach you anything about that game.
Yeah, no, I went and finished it. And I went and finished it, and it was. It was okay.
It was okay. But I remember when...
You know what? Its combat system was not nearly... I mean, I get the satisfaction of the combat system in Dark Souls. Like, it is supremely satisfying because it is very much... It feels... Oh, this word used to be more overused than it is now. I still feel a little overused. It feels very organic because it is just this natural thing of, I have my weapon, I have my shield, and I am in control of my position. And if I hit you hard with the shield, I might stagger you. If you hit me hard in my shield, I might get staggered.
Or risk it all and do a parry, you know, instead of blocking, I'm going to try. I mean, that. And would you need to have more precise timing? I'll tell you what, I'll give you the big sell, because I think you're a big racing game fan, are you not?
I'm a huge racing game fan.
And we'll talk about Real Racing 3. But it's a lot like a racing game where... And let me preface this by saying, the other thing about the combat system in Dark Souls is that the enemies always telegraph their moves.
They have tells
more than any other. Usually only the bosses in other games have major tells. Every enemy in Dark Souls, major tells, so that A, it's easier to recognize the patterns if you've died a lot. But B, it allows you, like a racing game. Racing games operate the same way. Usually there's like phases where... I think the most exhilarating part of a racing game is when you haven't raced the track before, and yet you're still able to pull off a first place. You know, like
really,
you kind of on the go.
Wow, we're so
you figure out the cornering, whatever. However, then there's the next phase that is also very satisfying, where you've raced it a million times, and now you know all the sweet spots. You know how to take the corners, whatever. You can only do that from repetition.
Yeah, like to me, the most exciting part of a racing game is, for instance, being like in second place on Road Atlanta, coming out of the chicane, coming down over the last hill into the final corner, and knowing that I know exactly where the brake spot is so I can dive inside and beat that inside line and hopefully overtake.
And that's, by the way, that's Dark Souls. It takes that same kind of mentality. But I think there's a secret joy in if you can pull it off the first run. If it, in a racing game, it's like, oh my God, that looks like a really tight turn. Like, as opposed, sometimes you don't know if a turn's going to be super tight or super long, but you just sort of, you figured it out. And then when you pull it off, you're like, oh my God, I did that without having to do it once already. I'm amazing.
But then it's like a real racer. Then it's like golf. And now you hit that shot from 150 yards out on a par three. But like the next time you're like thinking about it and you can't find that line, you're like, I know where that line is. And you just have to go back and learn it after
that. That's the ebb and flow. But yeah, those are the sweet spots of like, oh my God, it's inside. And I think it very much emulates... Whereas I think a Devil May Cry or whatever, they're so much more lenient in their combat system and even just in general adventuring gameplay, where you can make mistakes. You don't have to. Racing games, you can't really make mistakes, you know? Like, I mean, you have to, in order to progress, you need to.
Well, especially because the racing games are all set up on really short sprints, even though in real world races are lap after lap after lap.
Right.
Almost all racing games are like 3 to 5 lap races. So you're right. The window to make a mistake is very narrow.
Right.
Which is why they have to put in the awkward reverse, you know, like, oh, save your ass and rewind time.
Right. And anyway, that's my pitch. We should talk about Real Racing 3.
Well, I want to finish up on this, though.
Okay.
So here's my character flaw or character. It's not even necessarily a flaw. Here's my character attribute that makes this all a difficult question for me, and I'm sure it's magnified by, you know, over a decade of being in the media, writing reviews and being on deadlines and cramming through games, is that even when I'm playing a game on my own, I feel like every time I sit down to play the game, I want to feel like I have advanced my progress in the game X moves forward. You know, like I want to feel like I have taken the peg and I sat down at 6 o'clock, and at 7:30 when I had my little hour and a half to play something I wanted to, moved the peg forward an hour and a half worth in that game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a few deaths or a few setbacks within there, that's fine. But if I sit down for an hour and a half and when I go to save it, I'm in the same spot and facing the same stuff and have not advanced at all, then I really, like, that really eats away at me.
I'm trying to think back of my first playthrough, because now I've played through the game quite a bit. Because you do sort of repeat playthrough. I'm a New Game Plus now, and I've made several different characters. So now, It's hard to get back to the time where I was dying all the time. And I think there will be moments where you are stuck.
Yeah.
And even though you kind of... But the thing is, you know. You always know. It's not like another game where you're stuck and you're like, where do I freaking put the portal? You know, even though Portal is, it doesn't have that quite a bit because it's such a great, well-designed game. But you always kind of know. It's just a matter of pulling it off. And yes, you will have moments where you're stuck for a while. But as long as you... Once again... I would read, where do you think I should go? I'd watch the, I even played quite a bit. I'd watch the Let's Play,
mm-hmm.
pause it, and now I'm going to do it, and then watch it again, pause it, now I'm going to do it. But that to me was exciting. That didn't feel like I was cheating the game. It felt like...
That's like learning how to box or learning
exactly,
how to do anything else. You're
exactly.
You're learning how to play the game.
Exactly.
Yeah, I get it. I still, like...
I mean, look, it's not for everyone.
And that's
it's
what I'm saying is my character has been indelibly imprinted like this. And I'm sure there are people out there who be like, oh, well, you're the problem. I mean, people who are like into hardcore and want more hardcore like games like that. But then, I mean, obviously there's a number of games now that are sort of catering to the even more extreme side. Like, I don't need to have, I don't want everything just handed to me. I totally get that there needs to be a threshold of like resistance to get where you need to go, because mm-hmm. otherwise there's just nothing to it.
Mm-hmm.
I just need to feel like I'm getting somewhere when I play. And I'm sure part of it is just also, you know, not feeling like, I mean, look, I'm like older and have more job responsibilities and there's always things to do. And I try to spend, you know, good time at home with Ariel and all that other sort of stuff. So it's like, I feel like, oh, I just have this little window to play and I want to like get the maximum value out of it.
By the way, I used to do a Totally Rad Show where I reviewed movies and video games, and that whole time we reviewed Dark Souls, but I was only able to play so much of it and I moved on. It's kind of funny that when did I invest 200 hours in Dark Souls? Totally Rad Show is gone. I no longer am obligated to play the next game, although I ended up playing some of the latest releases this week. But I sat down and I dug into a game that I always wanted to dive into, that you need to dive into. You can't do it when you're on that schedule of having to play the
and
new
I try
game
like
week.
You know, when I was doing more media all the time, but even when I'm, you know, doing stuff for this show, I try really, really, really hard to recognize those pressures and sort of try and, you know, filter them out, apply the right filter against them, but they're still there.
Yeah,
I mean, it's like there's one thing to say, oh, I'm going to appreciate them and like put them into my critical thinking hat. And it's another thing to say, well, I'm just not going to, and they're not going to affect me because I'm super psychology person and I'm going to be able to turn off those pieces of my brain. And I can't really do that.
I do think the last game that I got like really deeply into, just because I was so in love with it, was Mirror's Edge, which ironically...
Yeah,
I love Mirror's Edge.
Which ironically, I also reviewed. I only gave it a 7, but like, I'm like, you know, but I still love that game. You know, I was so passionate about the mechanics of that game.
By the way, I played that. Play through that twice, and that has the same thing with the racing game, whereas you might have to die a lot and you may have to and then you learn it, but if you can hit a couple moments in your first playthrough of the level and you've actually figured out the line as you're doing it, you feel
it's amazing.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It's great when you get that like perfectly executed run.
Yes,
but yeah,
on the fly.
But being able to be like, oh shit, disarm this guy and just run, jump off the building, and you know, like doing that, you know, just on the fly is so satisfying. You know,
and that's another synchronicity between the player experience and the character that you're role playing as. Mm-hmm. That's what doing parkour is supposed to be, a spontaneous readjustment of line.
It's such a shame that they got caught up in any distraction with having to include gunplay.
I know.
Because it just wasn't necessary. It was a distraction.
I played my second playthrough, I did no guns.
There's
one spot where it's insane, but are they making us, do we know anymore? Is that a thing?
I mean, they keep on saying that.
Beyond prototypes that have been pitched around, but I mean, you know, very quietly, incidentally, EA has become a completely different company than it was 2 years ago. I mean, if you look at EA right now, like, although the factual documentation is there, no one's paid a lot of attention to this. They're not a AAA console game company first anymore. They're a mobile and social game company now that also has some studios making some, you know, big time console games.
The SimCity fans are like, oh my god, it's finally happening.
I know.
I feel the transition happening. Yeah. They're actually going to start talking about it.
Well, there have been some mobile SimCity games recently, right? I mean,
they made a mobile SimCity, but if you look at like their publishing schedule, they have, you know, a couple of dozen Facebook and iOS games out at any given time, and they're doing, you know, at the same time, a couple of three big time games. You know, they'll have like a Dead Space, Why on God's green earth a third Army of Two? I don't know. And then they have their sports franchises, but they're not any longer cranking out tons of big time games, right? It's like their emphasis is, well, we've got this suite of Chilingo games, and we've got all these EA partner games, not EA partner, but EA mobile games. And so, you know, and like you talked about, Real Racing 3, which is now their game as well.
Well, I mean, that's why they acquired
Mr. EA today.
That's why they acquired PopCap, you know, so many years ago. I mean, and, you know,
they've changed the company.
Well, you know, they always said that they were, you know, they were going to be well positioned, you know, should, you know, mobile take over. You know, they felt like they were confident in their ability to do that.
And I think it's those influences that, you know, that's why we also saw them talking about how microtransactions are going to be a part of all their games.
Well, they did rescind that comment.
They did.
Yeah.
So. They may have rescinded it. It's going to happen. They can rescind it all they want, but they're not going to say no to the money.
I mean, I think it can be done in a positive way. I mean, I think maybe we should talk about Real Racing 3, about how the economy works there, and how that could apply in, like, hardcore games. I think Real Racing is relatively, you know, core, quote-unquote, right?
Yeah, I mean, so Real Racing 3 is the third game in one of the most technically, you know, masterpiece iOS games. It's one of the ones, you know, the original Real Racing was a showpiece for iPad. Real Racing 2, likewise, showpiece for iPad 2. It really embodies everything that, you know, a big time simulation racer aspires to. Beautiful looking graphics, very detailed car models, a good physics and handling model that makes it feel very much like, you know, at least gives you the sensation of driving the car. Adapted well to pad. The most common way people play it is by tilting their device and using their fingers to have, like, just the brakes and having auto acceleration. So it gets all this stuff working. And the first two games were premium games. In other words, you paid for them. I think they were like $9.99, but they'd be on sale sometimes for like $3 or $4. I always waited for the sale. The new game, completely free to play, and adds real world tracks, which is cool. And I mean, do you want to talk about the economy first or the game?
I mean, let's talk about the game and then tell me about the economy. What is this game?
I think the game really is doing some very cool things. So one of the things that they have in there is a build off of, if you've played any of the EA racing games, you know about their autolog system, where it, like, it takes your friends and it tells you what your friends are doing at any given time. It's like, hey, Danny just raced in Need for Speed and beat your time on the Canyon Run in Need for Speed Most Wanted. Do you want to go fight him or whatever? So what they've done in Real Racing 3 is kind of extended this idea. They call it time-shifted multiplayer. And you're always racing against your friends, but it's not like a ghost race. It's you are on a race course with a field. I was on a field like with like 15 other cars, which I thought was a really impressive feat for the iOS device. And all of those vehicles are, quote unquote, being driven by my friends. So I don't know what the secret sauce is because they're not sharing it. But in essence, I go and drive Hockenheimring, right? Or I go drive Spa. Okay, I go drive Spa, and it records how fast I drove around the circuit. And then somehow or other, it creates an AI based off of the way that I drove and lets my friends drive against me.
But you're not reacting to the same... Like, if at one point you did that first race,
yep,
and you, like, saw a deer, and this is not, obviously, but you saw...
A deer!
And you went wildly left, and then you course-corrected, and you kept on going. How... Is it... If that deer didn't show up in your game...
That's just it. They're not doing that. So they're not. It's not a ghost race. So here's what's cool about it is, when I'm playing, it's as if I'm racing in real time with all of my friends,
right,
but I'm not really racing them. I mean, I'm racing an AI.
Just the time is the same.
And the time
the things
be,
that the car
and they can't doing. Control that. They can't control the time is the same, because let's say I'm racing now, yeah, and we're going into turn three and it's really tight and I push that guy way outside and then he gets involved with another car and then they wreck. Like, that's going to screw up their ability,
right,
to hit the time mark.
Right.
What they're doing is they're looking at how you drove and thinking about, you know, like, so, like, I'm sure they have, like, some, I mean, look, metrics have become the big, there's more data gathering going on in games than you can, right, imagine. So they know, you know, like, how aggressive you are, how hard you brake, how fast you are on straights, all those sorts of things. They can model, they can make a model of, here's how Danny drives when he's driving this car. And then when I go to play this game, it loads you in to that map, because you've already raced on that track, and now I get to race against you.
So it's Skynet's version of what they think you were doing.
Also,
right.
Garnet, most of Garnet's friends are just robots.
Yeah.
Yes, most of my friends are all robots and Facebook
sentient
bots. Or Twitter bots.
Twitter bots.
It's all Twitter bots.
Did you say iPad? Let me tell you about a great deal.
Oh, awesome. Click this link now. Three people already have free ones. Ask me how. Anyway. But I think it's really cool.
That is crazy, yeah.
The idea of like of them taking, and I mean, who knows how legit it is. I mean, look, they could all be smoke and mirrors. There could be absolutely no legitimacy to it whatsoever. But the simple reality is that when I'm out racing on Spa and I look up and I see like Jason's Facebook face head over his car, because it's like, that's the other thing, is it's pulling off of Facebook. So it's like, I know Jason's Facebook icon, I know John Davison's Facebook icon, and I'm like racing at the end of the race and they're right in front of me and it's like I'm racing against them.
I wonder if it's similar to the algorithm that they would use for a Madden, where they have to simulate how the Eagles would theoretically play this out based on their behavior. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you're theorizing based off of previous pattern. And
I mean, really, no one knows exactly how much juice there is behind this idea.
Right.
It might be really flimsy. It might be like, oh, we're just going to take like how fast they were and put them on the pole at that position. But it seems like that there's also some factoring in of how aggressive they are. And the racing, to be quite frank, like, it is really good pack racing. There's a lot of cars jostling in and out for position. There are, I mean, it's certainly more sophisticated than, you know, we used to talk about Gran Turismo as the example of cars on rails driving around the course, right?
Right.
It's definitely not that. I mean, Gran Turismo got way past that. But I was trying to think of an example like this.
Mario
has that
Kart.
It has sort of that real racing, not real racing, but race driver feel, the old Codemasters game, where there's like big groups of cars and sometimes they're not all on the perfect line and there's a lot of jockeying for position. And that also makes it feel like, yeah, I'm racing with my friends, because my friends would be like, look, I'm going to try and get around you. I'm not gonna hang back here. I'm not gonna just sit on the line. I'm gonna try and get around you. So the racing in it is really fun. The car selection is right there. I think there are 36 cars in the game, and something
so,
like that.
And so you can get that for free. How does that work?
You can get that for free. So here's the way that they have set up. Here's the way they have set up the system in order to encourage you to ultimately pay money to play this game. The progression in the game is locked around cars, and ultimately to finish, quote unquote, finish the game and have run all the races and done everything 100%, you would have to own every car that's in the game, because there are throughout the game the series of races are not divided by skills or groups. They're divided by groups of four cars. So for instance, the first one you'll hit has a Nissan Silvia, a Ford Focus, a BMW 1 Series, and I forget what the fourth car that's in there is. And you would have to buy one of those cars, and then you can race in all the races that are in that group of races. And of course, somewhere in there's a race that's only Ford Focuses and another one that's only Nissan Silvias. So eventually you would have to buy all the cars. And those cars all cost money. You start off the game, you have like enough money to buy the lowest two cars in that first bracket. So now you bought one car. And luckily, as I was telling Dan, I read the Touch Arcade article about the game before it came out, where they were talking about how best to position yourself to deal with the free-to-play situation, because the way they have it done is classic time gating, where, you know, once you get into the game, then you'll have to wait periodically to have things happen, or you can pay money to get past them. And the good advice that that Touch Arcade had was, don't fiddle with upgrading your first car off the bat. Don't do anything except stockpile money, and buy a second car. And buy a second car that's in a different bracket than your first car's bracket, right? So that you can be racing more frequently. Because the cars all have points of wear. I was telling Andrew, I forgot what the fifth one was, but it's like your tires wear out, you have to get oil change, your suspension wears down, your brakes wear down. Mm-hmm. And as you're racing, those things wear down, and they eventually get to the point where you need to repair them. When you repair them, it costs money, which you're earning by playing races, which is great, but they also take time. And so it's like, oh, do you want to have that repaired now? That would be 3 coins. So,
I mean, they're really taking that real racing mantra to another level. Like, you really got to pay for these repairs.
Yeah. I kind of like,
or you earn it through racing well, or no matter what, it's sort of design where you're gonna hit a wall where even if you've gotten first place every time, you're gonna hit a wall.
You're going to ultimately, well, right? You're gonna hit a paywall. Well, yeah. You don't or a time wall.
A time, right. Time,
and it's
right.
Up to you how you want to deal with it. Yeah. And actually, to tell you the truth, I mean, I think that in the context of being a racing game, it is kind of cool that your car wears down and that you need to repair it.
Yeah.
And look, I mean, I have other things going on. I don't mind if I get to dip in and play the game for, I played like 17% of the overall game, have two cars, have been all the way through, almost all the way through the Nissan Silvia series, and I'm well into the Skyline series. And I just like, I'll play up and I'll like stockpile everything that needs to be repaired and hit the repair buttons, and then I go do something else. And I come back to it, and then they're all repaired up and everything's set. So thus far, I haven't gotten to a harder wall, but I presume that, as is the case with most of these games, that the further you get into it, the closer they bring that paywall so that you eventually have to conquer it. So, for instance, getting into higher and higher classes, the cars are going to start costing a lot more money.
Like in real life. You see? You see how they're doing this?
Real racing.
So, whereas, like, right now, I'm earning enough money to keep up my Skyline and my Silvia and start putting away tens of thousands of gold, and I might be able to buy another $40,000 or $50,000 car in the not too distant future. Buying a $250,000 car might mean that I'm gonna have to go back and grind a bunch of races, and then that's,
but how can you grind? You can only grind races so much, because you're gonna hit the,
you're gonna do all the wear and tear on
your
car.
Well, but I would be earning more, so I'd be earning more coins than I was losing by,
I hope,
by attrition, right?
I hope so.
Yeah, I would be. I mean, you could set it up, and then you know you're buying mods. And the other thing, I did already find that the ultimate mod for the engine in my Silvia, which I got to because it's the last mod I have, is only available through the real currency system. So, and now you can earn those coins in different places, and then they're doing like these guys are savvy. They're doing all the little hot tricks right now. Like they gave me an ad earlier that was like, hey, watch this video and earn 3 coins, because that's another new way that, you know, that free-to-play games are being monetized, of this idea of like, oh, I know that you watched this movie and I know that I'm going to get paid by the advertiser, so I'll give you some real world money for it.
You know, this, I think this is really tricky. I'm playing on my phone because there's a game that I was playing, a more casual game. I don't think there's one game called Super Snack Time that had a similar situation. Oh, Jumping Thief is the name of the game. Fun game. I was having a lot of fun playing it. And then all of a sudden I hit a point where if I wanted to keep going, I could either pay or I have to wait 30 minutes or longer even for my thief to, I don't know what the thing, what the fiction behind the wait time was. And so I feel like in a game like Real Racing that in any other time would cost $10, and any other iteration it costs $10, and they're giving it to me for free, and it's a really slick high-end game, I'm a little bit more, and because it's a racing game, it's not a, although I guess a lot of people would feel this way, and this is sort of, I would pose this to you, it's not a just one more round kind of game where I'm like, I just want to keep playing. I might be more okay with, I'll just do a race. Oh, it's fun. That was fun. Cool. And then I'm more okay with stopping. But in this casual kind of hook you, I kind of want to keep playing. And then it hit me, gave me that wall. It's like, forget it. I don't want to, now I'm going to play something else, or I'm not going to remember. That length of time was so long that it's like, I'm not going to remember to pick up my phone and throw. It's not like Dragon Vale or Tiny Tower where it's like, it's an ongoing thing where I need to always upkeep. Yeah. And, blah, blah. And by the way, those games have that similar situation, but it's not a paywall.
Clash of Clans is raking in the bucks right now.
But there's always something to do. They don't say you're done playing. There's always something else to do. There's a lower rung. Now I just have to, while I'm waiting for this floor to be built, I can build this lower floor, whatever. There's always something else to do. In a game where, I mean, it's a tricky situation. If there's literally, and maybe it's accustomed to your time where you're doing other things, but if you get into a zone where you want to be playing and then it says you're not playing, I think it's a little, if it's not something as so high end as Real Racing, it's like, you got to be a great game for you to warrant that. If you're not a great game,
well, you know, it really,
no one can plan on
place.
Being a great game. Right, I know, but I'm just thinking it's risky for game makers that there's a way to make money if you're a really good game without having these paywalls that are like that.
That was true before free to play. I mean, good games hopefully get rewarded with sales. I mean, I think free to play gets a lot of flack from hardcore gamers, but I think actually ultimately at the end of the day it's a good thing. I just really hope that we see more flexibility in the pricing. I think a lot of us are afraid, like, oh, what if we just keep on spending money? Like, for me, Real Racing sounds great, and the fact that you don't have to pay to start, that's great. I mean, it's better than a demo.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's like, but like, okay, I really enjoyed this. Can I just give you guys $60 and just like get the full game?
but there's a difference between, because I think it is kind of like a demo. There's a difference between other IAP integrations where they make we were playing Life is Magic, right?
Yep.
For a bit, and it's like, oh, cool, I can make this go way quicker. Even if I don't want to make it go way quicker, I'll do the work. You know, I'll spend the time, or I can get a better item or what have you. And there's been times where I do that stuff. You know, I get sucked in. But to say I literally can't do anything in this game, I have to wait, that is kind of like a demo. It is like a timed demo, you know? And I would prefer other, and I think there's other ways of integrating it, make lots of money too.
In real racing,
that's what I'm.
You could reach that spot where you have your cars being under repair, but the repairs do not take a long time. There's like 5 to 10 minutes for repairs.
I'm cool with that.
And I think it's more likely the point that I'll reach will be that the higher end cars will be so expensive that I won't be able to earn gold fast enough in the lower end cars I'm in to satisfy that. And with the amount that I'm playing it right now and enjoying it, if it's a question of a couple of bucks to buy like a Porsche or a Lamborghini or a Maserati to keep racing for a while, I probably would do that, because you know what? I would have paid them $9-$10 for the game. So a couple of bucks to buy a car to keep playing it for right now, I'm cool with that.
But what if this becomes the norm? We're all sort of accustomed to this. We're cool with it.
Well, it's becoming the norm.
And then, right. So no, but I'm gonna say in our console games that we've paid $60 for, how do you feel about that? You know what I mean? Because that's sort of they're already okay with that. In the casual sphere, you know, they're already cool with that. I mean, DLC is sort of, you know what I mean? Like that's
oh, not only am I not only that not that cool with it, I think that potentially there's the opportunity to build AAA games that are free to play on console with the right monetization scheme and be way more successful. And it's only a matter of time before actually, you know what? The World of Tanks guys, wargaming.net will tell you they're already doing that. I mean, that's basically what they'll tell you they're doing. They may not have started there, but they have ramped that game up sufficiently that it's like, hey, we're making a AAA game and it's free to play and we know how to monetize it. And yeah, you know what? We have a budget that's sky high and we're also making money off of it. They're building that relationship.
Well, that's it. I mean, free to play, starting. Yeah. So are you, what would you rather? Would you rather spend $60 to have the whole thing or would you rather?
We'll take a break. We'll hold the thought. We'll come back on the other side and we'll think about this question for a minute. Would you rather have $60 games and no microtransactions, or are you cool with AAA games becoming microtransaction driven?
Free. You get this awesome game for free, but
Assassin's Creed 4 for free.
But
this episode of Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers, with info on over 50,000 console, handheld, iOS, and PC games. Get up-to-the-minute gaming news along with thousands of HD videos and screenshots. Get into the action by creating your own profile, post updates about what you're playing, and stay connected with friends and other gamers. Tired of standing in lines? Find great deals on new and used games, pre-order upcoming titles, and get Gamefly's daily deals all from the palm of your hand. If you're already a Gamefly member, manage your game queue on the go and keep games you like with just one tap. Get the Gamefly app for free today on your iPhone, iPad, and Android devices. All right, and it's that butt that will be lingering, but I want to go right to what I was about to say is the heart of the matter, which is this strikes to the core of something that John Davis and I were talking about on One Up Yours years and years ago, which is that at $50 and $60 a retail pop, games cannot, we've established a glass ceiling for games and for the size of the audience is what I mean, is that is a financial glass ceiling for people's involvement. Like we've proven with all these devices that we have, whether they be Android or iPhone phones or tablets of, you know, whatever form they might be.
Not Windows phones. You did not mention Windows phones. They're not eligible. Sorry.
Windows phones are eligible. Then we're willing to spend money on the hardware. But look, I mean, we continue to see a pretty similar number of unit sales across AAA games when they come out, despite the fact that like install bases for hardware is increased and there are more people out there playing games as we hear statistically, because $60 a pop for a game is a lot of money as an instantaneous purchase. Like that's not an impulse purchase. That's not something that I can take lightheartedly. That's for, you know, even like, you know, they once made the movie comparison, even going to the movie on a night is, even in LA, $30. and that's for two people, yeah. right? Like $60 is a one-time purchase.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I think that it will be very slow to happen. Just like it was an NPD report that came out earlier this week about packaged goods sales for games, and then noted that, you know, while digital games were still building, that there was a ton of room for digital games growth because retail packaged games still outsold digital games by more than 2-to-1, and also used games by more than 2-to-1. So it's like, yeah, people still are buying retail games, and that's been a slow shift, a slow move. And I think that this free-to-play movement will be equally slow because there's going to be a lot of reluctance. Imagine you're sitting in a boardroom at Ubisoft, and someone actually throws the idea out there, says, what if we made Assassin's Creed 4, you know, free?
I mean, I think
you would get laughed out of the building because it's a sure thing. It's a sure thing. You know, well,
no, I think they're having those conversations. I think we're approaching it the wrong way because we're approaching it as a or situation.
Well, that's the thing, is they're going to try and milk it for both ways, and that I don't think will be as successful.
No. It's not an and thing either. I think games are going to end up like the movie industry, where, you know what, when a movie comes out, there's multiple points where they're going to make revenue off of that game. They're going to have that theatrical release where the people that need to see it on day one, they're going to go out, they're going to watch it, they're going to spend money to see it just that one time. Okay, then you have a completely different audience that comes in, you know, a few months down the line, where they're going to pick it up on DVD or Blu-ray because they want to have ownership over that. And then a few months down the line, they're going to, you know, put it on video on demand and then have it
maybe
on Netflix. And they're all priced.
Although all of that is in flux, too. I mean, it's funny that you raise that analogy because that's the movie industry is going on with a very similar thing where things
and the thing is, and the movie industry is, you know, trying to add more flexibility. Regardless of medium, we want to consume things in as many different ways as possible. So we're going to see a lot of different avenues to the same content. So, you know, Assassin's Creed 4, you know, they're going to come out with the $60 game at launch, you know. But, like, in games right now, it's just, it's $60 at launch, and then just, you know, the price just keeps on dropping. What if, you know, and you've seen Sony actually experiment with it towards the tail end of this generation where, okay, so we have the $60 game. A year later, we'll just release it as free, but it'll be...
If you're a PlayStation Plus member. Yeah.
Or, you know, in the case of Uncharted 3, they recently just turned that game free-to-play. So, you know, it's...
Wait, what?
It's a year and a half.
Uncharted 3 multiplayer is free-to-play.
Yeah, the multiplayer.
But only up to level 20. So
once again, they're retrofitting free-to-play design, you know, into that. But, you know what? What otherwise would have been a game that stopped generating revenue... Now they're repurposing it.
I think what you were saying. I think it's not going to be Assassin's because of what you said, where they're going to make a poop ton.
I mean,
anyway,
they're going to look at it on the table.
Why
does
it matter
exactly? But convince a 60-year-old executive that the $60 game that they can almost take to the bank as selling at least 3 or 4 million copies of is revenue that they shouldn't take.
But the people who make Journey or Bastion or whatever, they might be the people that break, just like Louis C.K. did with his comedy special or Radiohead. Like, it's those kinds of people that will benefit from it and then prove to the bigger guys, oh, wait a second. This is interesting. This is another way of doing it.
Minecraft showed that, you know, you can a massively popular, you know, insanely profitable video game that, you know, completely sort of sidesteps the traditional retail model.
Yeah.
It needs to be in the console space rather than the mobile space, though.
I agree. Well, those are. Bastion and Journey are all
console. And you already see... So there's already interest and demand and impetus to have these things happen because we're seeing in the mobile space now, especially in the last few months, and, you know, because now I'm in working and publishing these games, I'm seeing a lot of these pitches, and there are no shortage of mobile game designs out there who are looking for $500,000 and up to go into the iTunes store. And I think that's really foolhardy because that is a different space. The iTunes store gets, I forget what it was, one of the mobile guys at the end of last year did a rap, but it's like 124 new games a day. So, and marketing is not, it's just still a very unstable, unproven format. But in the smaller number of title in the console space, which is a much different sort of space and has a different game layer, then you have the ability to still pop one of these games. And free to play is, I mean, let's not make a mistake, the economy of it is very numbers reliant. Like, so here's my complaint about why I think that it needs to be all at once is because you need to build up to that avatar release and then that scale of release and then have it be free to play so that you literally have, 60 million consoles and 40 million of them got the game because it was free and they started playing it. And then you can start working the internal dials that you have to play with how you generate revenue and get your average revenue per user where you need it to be and start making money off of the game. And then you've got a life cycle and now you can start building a game that you can perpetuate. That's what Wargaming did. That's why World of Tanks works so well, is that they got out there, they didn't do the big release because they didn't have that, but they built this community and they got themselves to a scale such that now they can keep reinvesting money in the game and seeing returns on it. So they keep, continually making the, they had like a big graphics push that makes the game look much better. And they keep working on adding more tanks and content to the game. And and we want to see that in our games. We want to see more content. The question also becomes, how do you do a single player game? How do you do an Assassin's Creed 4 as a free to play game?
Well, it's actually an interesting question that you raise, because specifically for you to say single player, because so much, especially in Assassin's Creed, so much effort is put into immersion, and it's hard to continue that immersion when you hit invisible walls that are to break this barrier. You have to pet, Like, there's really no, other than games like Mass Effect that have like credits and your Holocroft or whatever, you can purchase this mission because it's beamed to you from, that's how they don't break their immersion. But yeah, with a single player game, there's nothing. It's the casual game, real racing. It's not immersive. It's like, I'm already paying, I'm tapping to purchase on the iTunes store anyway. That's you're used to that. So that would be an interesting integration. Is how do you make free to play work when you're not? It's not like an MMO's free to play works because you're used to buying time in game anyway, and you're used to going out in your account and purchasing things. Although, man, the Uplay account, I mean, it might all run through stuff like that.
It would run through accounts. The answer. I think the answer is that you don't just try to take Assassin's Creed 4 and make it free to play in a model that exists right now.
Right.
You sit down at the design stage and say, okay, how can we make a relationship with the player where they can play the game and enjoy it, and we offer opportunities where we can monetize alongside of that that fit in harmony with the game? Maybe it's, let's say we're talking about Assassin's Creed 3. Maybe the shops inside the world that provide you with things have two systems of currencies, and you're figuring out how to balance those two currencies with how you're earning currency in the game. Maybe there are additional missions that you can take on while you're in the course of playing the game, some of which are premium that you have to go and purchase, others of which create currency for you. Some of them create the in-game currency. Some of them create premium currency.
See, the
there's so many
though,
systems you can build into the game, but you have to build them into the game. You can't just lay them on top.
But I will say, those kinds of things, like buying a new outfit for your guy or whatever, those things work in MMOs because you spend so much time playing those games and you're staring at the same thing.
Right.
You want the carrots on the stick of those games are aesthetics. They are getting this item that looks this way and whatever. That is not why we're playing Assassin's Creed. We're playing that game. The core of that is for the gameplay.
Yep.
So I would think the only way for them to monetize the free to play for those is like, how do we encourage a facet of gameplay? Which in like Assassin's Creed 3, it could be those awesome piratey, more puzzle-y missions. Those to play those, you need to pay for them.
I better say, I think 3 would actually be really easy to have monetized. It would be really easy to go in and figure out something with the ships and the repair system and procuring upgrades for the ship.
Or like you can sail on this. Well, this is your real racing thing. You can sail this ship and do the pirate mission tomorrow, Because it's being worked on right now.
Right.
Or you can sell on it right now and pay to get it repaired for our low price.
How would you feel if Dark Souls ever became like an arcade game where the game is free, but you just have to pay every time you die?
That would be brutal.
It would make death that much more intense.
If you're the guy who pulls it off in one quarter, you are a badass.
Exactly.
You're a demigod.
Exactly. Yeah. But the thing is, I think the future is actually really exciting because I think we're going to see a lot of games really experiment with this. I think there's, a lot of missed opportunities this generation. For me, the big example is Asura's Wrath. They made that a $60 game, threw it out there to die.
Yeah.
Why? All right, whatever, do that. But then, why didn't that turn into, an episodic game a year later where, get the first episode? That game is literally episodic, Just give people the first few episodes for free and then just, oh man, I really want to play the next episode.
I do think it really comes down to design alongside and really good game design and really thoughtful integration and in a player friendly and game friendly sort of way. I mean, I think there's a ton of opportunity here. Again, thinking about these games, we're all about DLC and DLC comes as paid DLC. Well, what if the developer is encouraged to continue creating content that's in the game and not as I need to make a new $9.99 DLC pack, but just as stuff they're constantly adding into the game that offers different trade-offs between how much time the player spends with playing stuff and accumulating wealth versus what they would want to spend. And there's always a new opportunity for a player to engage and what they might be able to do in the game and how much they might be able to earn. And the other thing is, if you're doing this sort of system, then for the player who's playing on the free side, who's playing on the I'm going to play through this through whatever the resistance side is, there's a supreme sense of accomplishment there as well, because you didn't buy your way forward anywhere, right? You've worked your way through it. I think that's really key, is that any of these games, they have to be friendly to the core player who's going to play the free-to-play arc and really put in the time to play it, because everyone's not going to do it. I mean, that's the thing. You got to be able to balance all that out and think about your design. Yeah.
So it's been about an hour. Can we talk about SimCity?
No, I don't think it's finished loading yet. I don't think the servers are up yet.
I can almost guarantee you that's true.
Oh dear.
Yeah, I wanted to play it. I wanted to talk about it with you, Garnet, but I could not, despite all of my best efforts.
So you had the worst case experience, obviously.
Probably, yeah, because I was on the group of people that. I bought it the night before. I thought I could get it at 9 p.m. I was hearing rumblings of that. Didn't happen at 9 p.m. I had a buddy that got it at midnight. And I, for some reason, even though I had already purchased it.
Well, your download didn't start at 9.
No. It said, I couldn't even download it. It said, when I went to go download it, it was grayed out.
Right.
And I clicked info and it said, released March 7th.
And you're like,
and I'm like, excuse me, it's not released March 7th. And then I Twittered that and people are like, oh, that's the European release date. I'm like, that's weird. And then I made sure my account said North America, whatever. And then the next day, March, or a day goes by, nothing happens. And then I guess March 6th, I see on Twitter the art director of the game saying that they're trying to patch, there's a bug where it thinks some North American people are on the whatever. So 3 hours before March 7th, they patch it, and I'm able to download it. But then upon downloading it, downloading the game that I paid for 3 days ago, that came out 3 days ago, I was unable to get onto any sort of server. And even today, before I came in, I was going to play a couple of hours before I come in to talk to you guys, and still I could not get on a server. Now, some people are getting on. Obviously, you got on, but
I was able
just
to play
hitting
a few times, but I have definitely hit the queues several times. I was on when they just spontaneously pulled the plug on the servers to work on them and didn't tell anybody and lost city data on that. How do you feel about this? Here's senior producer Kip Katsarelis' comment on the SimCity forums of Thursday. So this has been an exciting and challenging week for the team here at Maxis. The culmination years, by the way, I put a little SIC in there, a little sick. The culmination years of planning and development. We have been overwhelmed by the outpouring of support and enthusiasm from our fans, which has made it even more upsetting for us that technical issues have become more prominent in the last 24 hours. We're hitting a number of problems with our server architecture, which has seen players encountering bugs and long wait times to enter servers. This is obviously not the situation we wanted for our launch week, and we want you to know that we're putting everything we have at resolving these issues. Needless to say, neither there nor in the rest of the post was there anything that even said, we're sorry. There was no, first of all, there was no sorry in there.
Wow.
But there's also like the more troubling part of, this is the culmination of years of planning and development. Well, that's a little, I'm not sure how to respond to that without sounding like a complete dick, but if that's your years of planning and development, then you haven't really paid attention to any digital game launched in the last decade, period. Sorry. I mean, that's the raw facts. The raw facts are World of Warcraft was a decade ago, and your game is essentially the same as the first 12 servers of World of Warcraft. Oh, shit, everything's crashing all the time. Oh, my God, we need more servers. It's 2003 all over again, and that's not what I would expect from someone who's building SimCity. I mean, you have to know if you're making SimCity that you're making SimCity. Like where is the, I just don't get this idea that like we were surprised by how popular it is. You were really, because you're making SimCity.
EA so, was surprised when, you know, people played Battlefield 3. Remember how long it took for the servers to actually work for that game at launch?
I'm naive to this side of things. I was hearing you guys talk about before, and you were using lots of terms that I didn't quite understand, but shards and things like that. But explain to me, put yourself in their shoes. Let's try and get where they're coming from, because I just don't get. And especially, I was TO'd with Diablo 3, although that
and by the way, Diablo 3 was terrible, and I don't want to get totally drug into talking about that, because we slammed that when it had its failures,
right,
which were the same also.
But that's what I don't understand is, that it's going to happen, that it's very likely to happen, that servers are, I mean, like, you know what, that there's oftentimes a problem with this.
Here's the problem.
Technically no solution?
Well, there should be.
Is it a money saving thing where
it's a money
they spend less?
It's a money saving thing to this extent, Danny. So here's the deal. Let's say when you use super round numbers, let's say that they sold 10 million copies of SimCity in the first week. So in the first week, 10 million people bought this, and at any given time, a fuck ton of them are going to want to play at the same time, right? There's like a few million of them that at any given time that are wanting to play. But by the next week, that number has dropped off. And by the week after that number has really dropped off.
Right.
So though they sold 10 million copies, by the time they're 3 or 4 weeks in, they only need to be supporting concurrent players of like, you know, a few hundred thousand or maybe a million, million and a half or something like that. But during those first weeks, they got to support an awful lot of players.
Right.
Now, in a fixed server sort of situation, which it sounds like from the way they're adding stuff, and I've been reading some of the posts by different people who have engineering backgrounds on this, like their solution right now is not to add more instances on the existing servers. It's literally to add more servers. So like now there's not just USA West. There's USA West 1 and USA West 2. And then there's USA East and East 2.
Do you remember when, you know, you used to dial into AOL and, you know, your you know, local number.
Oh, primary number,
was,
number didn't work.
Yeah,
the next number.
So you had, you know, like a backup list of 10 other numbers. You know, that's essentially what they're doing, right?
Okay.
Right. So,
which, by the way, tricky, because if I want to play with my buddy, you have to be on the same server. Am I right
about
it?
You do indeed.
So if I try, just trying to get on the game, just pick a server that works for me, and he's
and,
on a different
and a server
one,
he can get in on the same time.
Or if so he's not, then we can't.
No.
Then we can't. Okay, so keep going. So the ad servers.
You would think that, and this is where I don't have the robust game server background to be able to say, yes, this is something you can do.
Mm-hmm.
But in content delivery, there's a obviously, when Gangnam Style took off, YouTube didn't crash, right?
Right.
I mean, it might have slowed down some, but that's because we now have the one thing people joke about the cloud, but this is what the cloud does. What the cloud does is it says, oh shit, there's a ton of demand for this video. I'm going to spawn multiple instances of it and put it around in different data centers around the world so that it can handle the load.
Right.
And you would think that in the world of cloud computing and cloud server distribution, that they would be able to do something like that with SimCity, where they could say, oh shit, there's a bunch of people who want to play right now. Let's spin up a bunch of cloud-based instances. And we'll spin up enough instances during this high peak of concurrency. So in other words, this high peak of a lot of people wanting to play at the same time, we'll spin up a lot of virtual servers so everybody can play, and then we'll just have that dynamic. And as people drop off and there are not as many people playing, we just won't have as many instances running. But instead, it seems like they're trying to run all their own servers, which means they got to throw a bunch of hardware at it now and have a bunch more capacity that in a few weeks they may not really need, you know, because now they're going to have overbuilt to handle this big rush.
Or enough people are going to be so angry by this launch situation that they're just never going to play ever again.
Whatever.
And problem fixed.
I think anyone who's purchased the game, you know,
they're going to want to play eventually.
So, But so I guess I'm just still unclear on what am I mad? Am I mad at that they were trying to save money and not purchase or rent or whatever servers to sustain the game for this high traffic period? Is that what I'm mad at them for? Or because it just doesn't.
They
are aware of a lot of people going down. We need to sustain people or it crashes. That's clearly a problem that they see and they have to solve that problem, but they didn't do it. The only choices are it's got to be monetary.
It's definitely monetary.
They're smart people.
It's definitely monetary. Right. I mean, they're taking a lot of money to the bank and they know, look, if we can
gambled, right.
And they might be happy. They know if we can weather the shitstorm for the next 3 weeks,
right.
Then we made all the money off of selling the game. We didn't need to have all those extra servers and we're going to keep making money really well.
So that's the gamble. If they weather. Do you think that they'll...
Oh, they'll weather it. But I mean, yeah. I think that the way they're weathering it right now is not good for them. And I think, so. First of all, it's perfectly reasonable. Like, I know, like, there's people making, it's weird. There are some gamers who want to come to defense of developers and say, oh, you should be understanding, like, this happens when multiplayer games launch. Well, 5 years ago, even, that was a shaky argument. But really, literally 10 years past last World of Warcraft, there's no reason that there should be no learning from that. Number one, if you bought a $60 game, you should be able to play it.
By the way, didn't Diablo 3 do a make good? Wasn't there some sort of make good with them? Like, they...
No, Diablo, like, Blizzard's been kind of crappy. Blizzard's been same thing. Hope you forgot about that. Hope you forgot about that and moved on. By the way, no, we still don't have the PvP thing working the way we promised.
right.
Yeah, no, Diablo 3's also been a mess.
So, but
pay attention, it's going to be on PlayStation. So that's really what you should be interested about with Diablo right now.
Right.
Smoke and mirrors.
But the people that made the game that we are like, I'm so really excited to play it, and it looks amazing, and I can't wait. They don't have a hand. They're different decision makers and the people that decide about servers. So how is the game? Is it amazing?
When you're building a game like this that from the outset has been designed as a service, because this game is only playable while connected to the server, this has to have been designed in concert with what does the server architecture look like? What does the distribution model look like? Mm. How do we make sure that people, whenever they're playing, wherever they're playing, are connected to our service? And what does that service run like? It's totally... Like, and just like it's disingenuous for them to say, we had no idea SimCity would be this popular. Oh my God, really? We didn't see any pre-order numbers. And like SimCity, no one's ever heard of that before. It's not like a game we've already made, you know, like, oh, 4 or 5.
I don't see a number.
Million
after
sellers.
SimCity. This is an original IP.
So they've never done this before. Who knew it would be popular? That I think the part that really gets under people's skin is that sort of cavalier attitude
about it.
Yeah. Like, SimCity popular? Oh my God, we had no idea it was going to be like this.
I mean, I think...
Servers crashing? Oh, we've never done this before.
Not only that, but that's a way of spinning it. So it's like, wow, this game is a great game.
Oh yeah, and even still...
It's so great that our servers crashed.
And the producer has to come back and be like, we're overwhelmed by the outpouring of support and enthusiasm.
Right,
the outpouring of support and enthusiasm. Here's the support. Amazon has taken the digital copy off sale because they have a little disclaimer right underneath there that says... Numerous players are reporting problems. I think you can read the verbiage of it on.
Apparently, Gamefly also took it down as well. So.
Because it's a disaster. And Amazon actually has made good because Amazon has great customer service, has been offering refunds. One of the things that's also irksome is that this does not qualify as an extreme measure or whatever for Origin.
I saw your tweet.
Origin's not offering refunds to digital customers. Look, if you bought the game for $60, like I understand, digitally, there's nothing for me to hand back. You could say, hey, I sold you this and now you've taken it. But if I don't have it authorized to play on my machine anymore, then theoretically I can't play it anymore. So I don't understand why if you're Origin and you sold me something for $60 and I cannot play it and it does not work, that you would say, nope, sorry, you can't return that. That's our policy. It might be your policy if I don't like it. It might be your policy if I bought it and play it for a little while and this
contract,
is what I thought it was.
The contract you signed with your money with Origin was I'm giving you this money to play this game now. You didn't buy it on layaway.
No.
That wasn't what was in the terms. It wasn't to play this game eventually.
You didn't read the fine print, actually. Their policy for online purchases does clearly state, though, that online digital purchases are not refundable.
Right, but doesn't it also say that this thing works?
No, probably doesn't.
No,
they're just selling your thing.
No, usually the EULAs actually include text to say that, like, you know,
as if it doesn't work. Yeah. Right.
Well, it's not even an as is thing. You know, there's just, you know, there could always be service disruptions and, you know, which can interfere with.
I couldn't even download it. So.
Ultimately, we shouldn't be focusing on the technicalities, like, oh, how many servers are there? How could there not be enough servers? You know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, well, what's right, you know, what's the right thing to do, you know?
Oh, are you still talking? Because I just want to hear about the game, kind of, like, should I be excited to play it eventually? Is it
maybe
not all that?
I don't know. I mean, I have some places. What's interesting about this is that people who love SimCity are already dropping back to playing SimCity 4 or SimCity 2000, and that also raises a bigger question of, like, those games are 10 years old. Does there anyone that really thinks that 10 years from now, the SimCity 5 servers will be turned on? Really? Does anyone believe for a millisecond that 10 years from now you will be able to play this game?
Oh, no, not EA. I mean, they announce server closures every year. So.
There's virtually no chance of that happening. I mean, I suppose that there's some chance it could happen. But realistically, you know, even 5 years from now, like, there's realistic chances they may not have their servers open. Now, they could theoretically
transfer the client.
Well, or change the client, you know, switch the service so that, like, you know, eventually you would download all the files onto your computer and be able to play without it being connected all the time.
I mean, I think a lot of people are really frustrated, you know, obviously because they can't play the game that they bought, but, you know, there's also that fear that this is the future of gaming, you know,
and that
not being able to play games at launch, that's just going to be a commonplace thing.
It's the future of everything, though. You know, it's movies. I mean, it's funny we were talking about this, but Netflix streaming, I don't buy Blu-rays anymore. You know, I don't want to own anything. I just want to be able to grab it from online, and everything's like that.
Even for stuff you really love, like Planet Earth or...
Yeah, well, especially those box sets, because that's what takes up the most room, and you know what I mean? And I don't want to have to get up and put the thing in. I'd rather just see what do I have right there. So I mean, by the way, I just bought Willow on Blu-ray, so there are exceptions. But so I think that in general, this is a problem. I don't think this is a gaming-specific problem. We are going to be connected to the internet, and it's going to be like power, you know, in terms of, it sucks when our power goes out,
yeah,
but it doesn't like that, and our internet's gonna go out. Hopefully our internet goes out as infrequent as our power goes out. Mine goes out way too often that it's terrifying, the idea of, oh my god, then I couldn't play any game or get my documents because everything's cloud connected or whatever. That's very scary. But I hope that I'm sure power was like that in you know, the early 20th century.
Power's actually still like that in a lot of countries.
Sure. Yes. For our international listeners, I'm sorry if I sound elitist. But
spoiled Americans.
I know. Running water.
But anyway, so I think that it's not... I think that it's terrifying, but it's also going to be so ingrained with everything in our culture that it hopefully this stuff smooths out, because it's... Everything is accessed that way. Yep. It's not just games that are accessed through digital distribution. It's all
certainly,
things. It
certainly throws a big warning flag to Microsoft if the rumors about an always connected Xbox are in any way true or had been true. I hope, no hope. I mean, they certainly have to be watching this situation and seeing how it develops. All right. We'll take a break. When we come back on this side, we'll talk about SimCity, the game piece. And then we can talk about always connected consoles. And I don't know, we can talk about whatever else you guys want to talk about. We got one more segment to go. Stick around. Weekend Confirmed. We'll be right back. I close my eyes on the dance floor. Forget about you. I lose myself. Flashing colors, I've got to see it through. You're too much, I take it that we're over. Should we even care at all? Too much, too much. Let's shake hands and say goodbye. See, it's not always just dance music. There's some skeleton boys there, right? Good stuff. You should check it out. Well, I'll put the music links back in the show. I've been meaning to do that. So I'm going to give you guys some awesome rant fuel here because this is hilarious stuff. So we're talking about SimCity. We'll get into the game in a second. But the Minnesota Vikings kicker, Chris Klue, which I guess that's how you pronounce his last name. I'm sorry, Vikings fans, if that's wrong. It's K-L-U-W-E. Klue, sounds right?
That sounds good.
Anyway, he's apparently a big gamer, and he's been playing SimCity quite a bit and has taken to Twitter to talk some about SimCities. Like, you know, I really enjoy the queue system of SimCity. I mean, it's not a queue. It's actually a chance to get in the game. Another one here is that so far I've cycled through it 4 times, and it always bumps me back to the same 209 countdown. Not really a great queue system. He also points out not bothering a new server because they don't transfer over. He notes that, hey, at SimCity is the official account, so let's have some fun. Followed by, so, at SimCity, would you qualify this current state of affairs as, quote, unmitigated clusterfuck or a, quote, royal screwing of loyal customers? He falls into, like, video game, angry video game guy really easily. Yeah, like, yeah. He's got it down.
Man, you know, sometimes God gives people, you know, just...
too many talents, yeah. Right? He can play football and he can trash talk the video game developer.
He knows his shit.
I complain about video games and I can't play football for shit.
Right. Well, he's a punter, so he can't play football either.
Oh, snaps.
It says, at SimCity, can you tell me why the Diablo 3 launch didn't inform you on how incredibly stupid the idea of always on DRM really is? Pretty much nailing it to the wall.
It's not DRM, though. You know, it is always on, but you know it is not DRM. So.
Then the last two are. I mean, this is the part where I've like actually said something about this when I was tweeting about this yesterday. Like, this is on the brink of getting really ugly. This is what I meant by getting really ugly. I guess what I'm really wondering at SimCity is why people should ever buy one of your products in the future based on this experience. And number two, now let's hit the big fish. Hey, at EA, how does it feel to successfully run a developer's image into the ground? Does it make you feel good? That's pretty tough, but I think that...
I mean, BioWare fans would argue that they've already done it.
I think it's pretty tough, but I think that sadly that there's definitely some scorched earth that's being left behind here that's extreme and tough. And it's before we even talk about the game. And by the way, the game is not going to make every SimCity fan happy. And to answer your question, Dan, I don't know. Like, I played a few hours of it now. And they've certainly changed a number of things about the game. So, if you...
I mean from previous iterations or from what you've seen at E3 and...
From previous iterations of the game. So, okay. I watched a little bit about SimCity early on and then sort of, like, pulled my head out of it because it was getting me so excited. Like, I love SimCity. I've been dying for SimCity for a long time. I mean, like, they've been hinting and false starting on making this SimCity for a long time. Now that they finally built it... I think it's interesting that they moved away from a number of things that fans really enjoyed. One, I mean, obviously, the first one right off the bat, it's been talked about a million times, is the size of the city. The size of the individual city that you build is not very large. You will outgrow it very quickly. Mm. You will expand to its edges. Now, this is interesting if you are not put off by it, in that it does force you to then start to try and manipulate the situation to improve density, because you are, it's San Francisco. You know, you are physically bound within that area. So if you are going to improve the size and scope of your city, you're going to have to build up. There's no more building out that you can get to that point. But I think you'd also say that, like, the plot that they're giving you is too small, and it's intentional. It's by design. The way that they looked at the game is that what used to be your city is now better thought of as the region map, and that within your region, there are a number of cities, but those cities are more like the districts that will wind up being different things to your city. So yes, you will probably have a combination of like residential and industrial and commercial in a city. It's likely that your cities are going to be predominantly one thing. Like, you're going to go to a city, it's going to be mostly like residences, and there might be some industry that people go to and some commercial to support that. But you know, each of these cities will wind up having things they do and sharing resources between them.
You're saying cities that you make on your region,
yep.
You will make multiple. You'll make a resident suburbs. You'll make a industrial complex. You'll make
So it's trying to get to that.
And then My City will also be in that region with you, right?
Depends on if you want to do it like
if,
that.
If you want to.
So you're building a Santa Monica, and then you're building
Long Beach,
West Hollywood. And West,
yeah.
Got it. So once again, apologize to our international listeners, but this is California talk.
They're all terrible. Yeah. So.
And you don't have power anyway, so you're not even listening to this.
Like, when it works, like, on paper, that sounds pretty cool, right? It's like, oh, okay, I get it. Like, now I'm, like, when you were building your old cities, there was always this challenge of how do I really get my high wealth residential area off to the side and segregated enough that it's not negatively influenced by the industrial development that I've done elsewhere on the map? And how do I really get where I can pull those two apart and really make this very cool enclave of high commercial? Like, I want to build the coolest shopping mecca and office building park ever. How do I really get that part of my city to develop? But that was also a cool thing that you had to work around. Well, now it is taking that little chunk out and putting that chunk into its own city space.
Okay.
So you can really focus on, like,
that just sounds cool to me. What would be the negative?
Just, like,
of
ramming tons of coffee shops into one district and see what happens.
Right. Well, you get Seattle.
Yeah.
Well, so there's a number of negatives to it. Okay. I mean, for one thing, if part of the joy for you was seeing all those systems interacting, it's more abstracted now. It's more difficult to see all those systems abstracted. So if you want to see what's happening with how the pieces are interacting with each other, you have to jump out to the region view. So and then it also creates some weird pressures depending on how you're developing. This really comes into play in multiplayer, because I started a city in one of the multiplayer regions, and right off the bat, because there were other cities that had already developed, my city was like super high residential demand. And two and a half days of playing it later, I can't do anything but build residential, because all my city demand is being sucked up for residential. Mm. And it's just they're all commuting out to go to the other cities to work in. So that's cool, except that
you just saying that to me sounds rad. You know what I mean?
It is, like, kind of cool.
That's kind of cool that you just said that sentence.
It is kind of cool, except that I am stuck trying to figure out how to just build this residential community. And there are other parts of the city management that I want to tweak, that I want to sit in there and, like, fiddle around and play with.
Yeah.
And so if I really want to do that, I probably have to build my own region and then control all of the plots independently.
Right.
But the other thing that undermines this, if that was such a big deal, I mean, there's obviously a disconnect between the design aspiration of this SimCity and the technical ability of it to pull it off. Because though this sounds really cool, and you probably heard that you can have 16 city regions, you can, except that your city only shares with the two adjacent cities in your little space. So though you're looking at this big region map, you're not actually playing with all those other people. You're only playing with the two cities that are adjacent to you, which sort of undermines this whole thing to a degree also.
Wait, so if you really want, like, a garbage disposal area, it has to be next to one of your cities? It can't actually
So think about them as being chained together, city one, city two, and I'm drawing them, like, in little city three, city four.
Garnett is drawing something on a radio show right now.
I know, I'm showing it for you, though, so you get it.
He's circles on the page.
So, like, this at any given time, your city is working with the adjacent cities that are connected to it.
See.
But they're not. But you're not working to cities that are any more removed than that.
I also see. You guys can't, but I see.
So it's it's circle with a line, with a circle with a line, with a circle line, and only, you're only connected to the ones that
you're
have
only connected
a road
to the cities
you,
right next to
not
you.
Not with the one that has a road connected to the one that's next to you.
Right. So you go back out of this region view, and you're looking at this region view, and you're like, oh, look, there's this cool city over here that has a port, and there's other city back over here that's building all this, but you can't get to them.
Right.
Because you're not connected to them. And not only you're not even connected to them.
Even if they're yours, even if you built them.
Then you're not connected to them.
Yeah.
You're not connected to them. And the rail service, like, you would think, oh, well, maybe rail would be. No, rail doesn't connect them, because even the rail just runs in, like, these little loops between, like, these little groups of cities that are connected together. So you're in a big region, but only little groups of cities within that region are connected together.
Sounds like a patched thing that would
it
be.
It sort of undermines this whole idea of all this unique interaction.
How much of that is, like, limited because of
Is that one of their higher-end limitations they put on the servers?
I mean, I have no idea. Have you been playing the game at, like, full operation?
Yes.
It's like the Death Star. It's
so there's a patch that came out. What they're joking about is there's a patch that came out yesterday that disabled leaderboards and disabled some region sharing region when you're so when you go into the game, there's a SimCity World thing where you can look at all the regions that are being played, and I think that's what they disabled with some of that. But they did also disable the, you know, if you played SimCity before, there's three speeds the simulation can run at. You can run it at the slowest speed, the middle speed, or the high speed. The high speed is called Cheetah, and they disabled Cheetah speed.
Oh.
And I guess they disabled it because...
What about ludicrous speed? Can you run it at ludicrous
speed? It's gone plaid! I think that they must have done that because this game, back to that thing about service, this game is a service. So obviously, you know, it's constantly on the fly saving all this data. And when it was run, when everybody's trying to play at the same time, running it, a bunch of them at cheetah speed, just the amount of raw data that it's trying to keep track of for all these cities being run all over the world was too much for it.
Mm.
And it's also that on the fly, that constant state of synchronization that I'm not sure I haven't. This is the thing. Like, there are reviews out for SimCity now, and I think that that was a necessary thing. And that's a whole other discussion. And people played it, and they played a lot of it to make those reviews. But this is a game that, like, it just has a lot of concepts that will take some real time, real long term time playing the game to decide how you feel about them. And this is another one of them. As a, literally, I was degreed in landscape architecture. I've taken city planning courses. This is one shot, and that's that city planning. And it's a little bit weird because this is, there's no longer any ability to reload an old save. There's no ability to play around with anything. Once you've, when you lay a road, the road is laid. That is that. The only way to get rid of that load, or the load, that road, is to go back with the bulldozer and bulldoze it. And so you're out that money, and every move is indelible. Mm. It's when I was learning.
It's like Iron Man mode in XCOM. That
it is Iron,
great.
It's constant Iron Man mode.
Yeah.
Which, and if you think of, I mean, one of the like Zen-like properties of SimCity is you can envision yourself sort of sitting at the architect's table designing your city, and it comes to life off of the mat, right? I can tell you, as someone who's done that a bunch of times, you never sat down in one take and just did it. You know, granted, everything's done now on computer and CAD systems, but when I was learning, I didn't realize it sounds awful when I was learning. Hmm. You know, we still did drawings with real like instruments and stuff.
But then color TV came out and changed everything.
And one of the prominent ways that, you know, archival drawings, all archival prints for blueprints were made is this stuff called Mylar. And Mylar is this plastic drafting film that has it's like a powder coat finish on it. And you would draw on it in technical ink pens. And when you drew on it in technical ink pens, I mean, you could buff up a line kind of, sort of, but it did make a bit of a mess. But when you drew on it, like, that was it. Like, you were committing to your design. So when you did the design, you would sit down with this stuff called trace paper, and you would, like, roll out trace paper over what you were going to work on, and you'd sketch out your ideas, and you'd play with it and move them around. And that's the beauty of design. That's the fun of design. The fun part isn't sitting there with your tech pens and figuring out, you know, your double aught and drawing like this perfect little beautiful straight line and saying, that's where my road's going. The fun of it is like sitting there with all your sketch paper and going, well, what if I put a road here? Then that gives me this much space. And then I have this over here. And then, nope. Like, let me erase that or move this. And this game doesn't really foster that sort of play anymore because... Mm. You have to, well, it does, except you just have to be willing to accept that, shit, I didn't want to put that road there. Well, you know what? When I've got another 1,000 simoleons, I'm going to bulldoze it because that wasn't where I wanted to put it.
Yeah, that's a very negative. It's sort of, there's a negative, as opposed to the flourishing creativity of experimentation, you know, is what you're speaking to, basically.
Yeah.
It's like you want to be, I play one of those coaster games for iPad, and it's like you want to, before you commit, or you can always delete. You can go down a wrong path and lay out my track and da da da. And then if it doesn't look right or doesn't all connect, oh, I'll just delete it. And it's all about, because the end result is, how do I make this cool thing?
Exactly.
It's not about like God. There's a degree of God simulated. Like, oh, this is what, because when you really plan a city, if you build that road, it's also an experience to have to bulldoze it, right? And I think that's where it's going after.
I get it.
Maybe that's why. It explains the smaller city size, because instead of wanting you to perfect your city, it's just make another one, learning from that, maybe, just throwing that out there. But I agree that really you want to feel encouraged to experiment. That's where the fun,
well,
lies, as opposed
to
feel
catch...
like, oh, now I cost money, and it has this negative.
From having studied this stuff, I think that they're actually trying to capture the idea of, over a period of decades, what is it like to have laid down a city structure right. and then have to come back and figure out how to revitalize it? And right. much like you see in real urban settings, you know, entire roadways are torn out and land is reparceled. But this idea of like doing that in the real world, when that happens in the real world, it's not that someone just came along and said, oh, we're going to do it. Planners were sitting down and replatting all that land and figuring it all out in a design process. And they haven't given me what yet I'm really feeling a good way to do that.
I mean, the impression that I get is that the new SimCity is less of a toy and more of a challenge, you know, more of like a
simulation challenge.
It sounds like, it's asking you like, well, these are the problems that, you know, people are facing now. And, you know, a lot of the promotion for the game is like, well, you know, there's limited resources. That's something that, you know, we're actually, you know, struggling with in real life in many cities. And, you know, it's like, how can you tackle these very difficult solutions? And can you enjoy the stress, the fun and the stress of being like a person in that kind of position, you know? Versus, you know, let's just have fun and Bowser comes in and destroys your city.
Well, it's funny because a part of my excitement for the game came from watching the presentation at E3, probably the last E3, and seeing the, like, if you have crime in your area, it goes into the other person's area, and you can actually watch the shootout unfold, and you see all these things in real time. You know, like, the fun of, you know, when you said toy, it reminded me of, yeah, that's what I liked. I like the idea that it was like this toy to see how things react. However, oftentimes that's a very casual experience and it's ephemeral. You know, I will only play that kind of game for so long because ultimately I go, why am I doing that? What am I? Oh, that's awesome. That's really cool. Okay. And then, but if you don't have goals, if you don't have those challenges, then it's a very limited experience. So, I'm wondering now my reaction to the game. Will I be bummed that it took out some of the fun? Will I be really hooked because
there are other fun?
It might like give you a different scratch to itch. You know?
Yeah.
A different itch to scratch.
Yes.
Even
maybe
or a different scratch to itch.
Yeah.
How do you feel about this? One of the things. I mean, it's clear. Well, I would say my conjecture is that they're. Design approach is more City of Sims than Sim City. If the differentiation is, you know, in Sim City, I'm playing with simming city pieces and I want to tinker with city infrastructure tools. And here I do those things, but really what I'm trying to do is figure out how to deal with my Sims' livelihoods and lives. And so now, you know, one of the things that is pretty spectacular is you can literally burrow in to click on every single Sim in the city anywhere, see what they're doing, where they're going,
cool.
where they live, where they work, where they shop, blah, 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 all that stuff.
I cannot wait for the Katy Perry expansion pack. So good.
Well, I'm sure there's going to be some memes that come out with SimCity as, you know. By the way, I'd be shocked if there isn't already an Angry Hitler video yelling at...
I'm sure there is one someplace, right? Yeah. The other thing is, if you got to, you know, one of the things about getting to a high level of SimCity was always how cool can you make your city look? How densely packed can you get it? How big can you get it? Well, one of the things that is challenging here is that there's another disconnect potentially between the aspiration of the design and tech limitations. You've got curved roads now. Curved roads are cool. The problem is curved roads, when they intersect with any sort of right angle roads, create really odd parcel shapes. And the procedurally generated stuff that goes in them doesn't know how to deal with that because there's too many options and it just winds up with weird, awkward blank spots all throughout your city.
Weird.
Especially early on. So let's say you create this curvy road that looks like something out of a modern subdivision, but where it goes up and meets the main thoroughfare, there's that weird, like, the on one side it's like a big splayed open piece of land. On the other side, it's like a really tight piece of land. And all the machine knows how to do is drop houses into like little weird special rectangles. So it gets down to the end, it's like, oh, I can't drop one here, but I can't drop one around the corner either. So there's just big open corner. It doesn't know what to do with it.
Well, the moral of the story is why are you building curved roads? God, just be like New York. Make grid system. That's what I'm going to do when I go into.
And you see a lot of people already resorting back to that. And the game even shows you dotted lines of like, here's the most efficient layout plan for your roads. So if we're just going back to that, well, why don't I just at this point? Why don't I just click a button and have it pre-populate this plot with all of the right roads?
They wanted you to learn how inefficient curved roads were. You see, it's a life lesson. They wanted you to be like, hey, look, we were giving you these tools, and go make L.A. Oh yeah. That was a mistake.
But you can't make L.A. because the other thing is like there's no subways in the game.
There's no subways in L.A.
Yeah, I was going to say. There's subways in L.A. You can make L.A.
There's like a five-stop subway somewhere in downtown.
Well, you can't make New York. There's no subways in the game. Okay. And on the whole, like, one of the things that's... So here's another thing that they did. You no longer zone by density. Your density is determined by the street density.
You are my density.
So you pick like, let's say you want to build, you want regular like residential building here. Then you put a low density street in. But if you eventually want, you know, like apartment buildings, then you would make a medium density street there, right? Here's the problem is they got so caught up in streets and then densities that they forgot about or seemingly didn't account for the changes in traffic based off of population density. So if I have a street and it's determining what sort of development goes next to it by density type. So low density street, medium density street, high density street. It also needs to take into account the amount of traffic that would be derived from what sort of development goes next to it. But that doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to be the case that if you lay a street can handle street level of vehicular traffic. So if I put heavy density on a street, suddenly I've created a shitstorm. So I have to really think about that. But then there's
the lack of public transportation really is shocking in terms of like actual city planning, you know, especially if we're talking about density now.
Yeah.
Clearly,
streetcars
in real life, if there was that much traffic density, you know, you would have a large number of those Sims opt to do public transportation instead.
And it's very difficult to get especially early on, you can create massive traffic cluster fucks early on and not be remotely ready to be able to put in any sort of mass transit. And there's not enough granularity in road type. So it immediately jumps from street to boulevard. If you think about a modern street system, there are a number of levels of streets that move people throughout neighborhoods from, you know, major thoroughfares to arterials to locals. And it doesn't reflect that. It goes from little bitty street, it goes dirt road, street, boulevard.
The odd thing is, in spite of Garnett like complaining about this, every time like I'm actually still getting more excited for this game. Like the fact that you're talking about this, I still want to play that for myself.
Me
I won't
too.
Be able to. But
did you purchase it or no?
I have a Mac. I prepared to not play the game at launch.
Right. So. I have a Mac. And so all I said, I mean, what I played of it, I was enjoying because as systems this is one of those games that's frustrating because there are moments where you see those flashes of things and you're like, shit, that's really cool. But then there are the other things that you're like, that's really an impediment and annoying. Like, you know, just a minor point, but if you're really trying to be immersed in this idea of being a city planner and you're working in the region, the city plots are all spread out over this region and there's just weird no man's land in between. With inexplicable, no reason for it to be there, no man's land.
Those are the people that are still waiting for SimCity to load.
Or your city can be like right next to the coast, but because the edge of your city boundary didn't include the coast, you can't build a port because your city didn't go all the way down to the. You're like, but the coast is right there. Right. These people would want to build a port. Nope, sorry, you can't build a port. The port plot was actually the other city parcel in this region.
It's kind of like the uncanny valley of this kind of game where it's so. Seems so true to city planning that you should be able to do certain things, but yet it's still not for real city. Like it still is just working on algorithms and things. Like,
but you are creating yourself a very cool little world. But when it works, and when it works, it is really cool. Like when I'm looking at my city and realizing, oh, my city is providing all the workers who are commuting over to Corey's city to like work in his factories, and then they're coming back here. And if I built some commercial, maybe they'd have like some money to spend. And then you start to think of like these interesting reactions between those, and that's cool.
By the way, what's your city called?
What did I call my first? Oh, I call my first city Area 51 because it's experimental. It's experimental, you know.
That's awesome.
We'll get to the like Leesvilles and the Williamsburgs later on, but the first one was very much experimental, so it's Area 51.
That's cool.
Actually, it's kind of Area 51.5. I wanted to raise it and start over. So that's the thing, isn't you can't destroy it. Like I started off and I realized I had gotten way too cute with the street design and really screwed it up. And I was like, well, shit, I guess I can at least probably punch out and restart. No. The way the game works, this is where they get into this hardcore urban decay modeling thing. And this is kind of conceptually cool. You can abandon a city in a region, but you can't just tear it down and start over. If you abandon it, it's just sitting there doing its thing still.
And then it just turns into Detroit.
In situ. But someone else could come in and take over. Oh. So someone else could come along and say, oh, look, I want to play in this region. Here's this abandoned city. I could go in and that's that cool. You could see in a few weeks people being like, you know what? I'm going to go look at regions that have abandoned cities and see if I can fix them.
Wow.
I'm going to see if I can go in and fix whatever's screwed up in this city.
That's cool.
And it just creates dynamic challenges like that. That's pretty cool.
That would actually be a cool mode in the game, even, is if you had challenge mode where it's like, do this to my city and see if I can overcome it.
Well, there are disasters.
There are. Oh, okay.
And zombies.
Oh my God.
Of course, zombies show up. It's silly. Zombies don't have to be in everything.
Yeah, that should have been DLC. God.
Well, I'm sure there'll be DLC. I hope they get through this. I hope that they get through. I'm really curious. We haven't really, but just scratched the surface. And, it'll be good when Jeff gets back next week. Hopefully the game will be more playable and I can play more of it. And Dan, you can play some before you come back. You'll come back, right?
Yeah.
I really like having Dan here.
I'm playing it. I like being here.
What do you guys think of having Danny on? Hopefully you're all enjoying it.
Yeah, well, I'll replace Jeff when he goes and does his new show.
Oh, yeah. He has a new show.
If you want more of him, you should really contribute to Jeff's Kickstarter and just keep
him.
Yeah, there you go.
Give him more incentive to never come back.
Full circle on the podcast.
Should I say anything about Tomb Raider at some point?
We kind of reached the end of the show.
Okay.
Do you want to say
it's
something?
It's cool. You can use it.
We can do
I'll do it as
move.
my slam dance. Yeah, my finishing move.
There you go. Let's do slam dances.
It's the weekend, and it's time for Finishing Moves.
All right. That's an awesome lead-in, and we will let Danny kick off as the guest of honor.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to mention something about Tomb Raider, but there's been enough praise for that game, right? It's a AAA title.
It has no shortage of praises.
Yes. And it's a fun game. It's super fun. But Runner 2 had me hooked this week. And despite my 200 hours of Dark Souls and trying out Tomb Raider, I had to play some Runner 2. I was a big fan of Bit Trip Runner. And this Runner 2 is everything that I wanted when I played Bit Trip. I wanted the same game. I just wanted to look a little bit better, and it delivers. But there's a little bit more depth. There's more moves. You kick people. You slide. I guess
slide.
There's slide. But this is jump, slide, kick, and there's probably other things on the way. Floating in the jumps, a little floating action. Mm. So tons of fun. Just as grueling. It's such a joyous, Bit Trip was a little bit depressing, it was very sort of a darker game, not that it was depressing, but it was a little bit darker, so it wasn't as pleasant an experience despite that wonderful music. This game has the wonderful music, but with a bright, really, really buttery graphics, and it's just a joy to play.
Awesome. I'm all about Bit Trip stuff. I do like Bit Trip stuff quite a bit. All the way back to Bit Trip Beep.
Hmm.
Andrew?
All right, so I said I was going to talk about F-Zero GX at the beginning of the podcast.
I will talk about it now.
And so I will, because it is a great game, and the best futuristic racing game, bar none. And actually, so I was writing a story today, which I hyperbolically claimed is the best story ever.
For today.
For today, at least. Apparently someone discovered that F-Zero AX, which is the arcade version of the game that Sega developed.
Which is GX?
So F-Zero GX was the last proper F-Zero game that Nintendo made back in 2004 or whatever on the GameCube. And it also had an arcade version come out at the same time called F-Zero AX. Because the game was developed by Sega. And that arcade game was incredible. I mean, I don't know how many people have had the fortune of actually ever seeing an AX machine in real life, but that thing is it's just so much fun. If you
could see Andrew's glowing eyes right now.
It's like Christmas. He can't even contain.
You strap yourself in, and all these warning labels everywhere, just being like, you will get hurt playing this game, pretty much. It's guaranteed that, just the amount of impact and the shaking and the
dude,
it is the best.
It's a Dark Souls of racing games.
It is. Well, it is. Yeah, it's one of the hardest racing games ever. The story mode is insanely punishing. And I sort of wish GameCube had achievements back then, because I did actually beat story mode on hard, which is something that's absurd. But anyway, So F-Zero GX, actually, if you beat it, you know, and get like gold on everything, you'll unlock the AX tracks, which are four tracks that were in the arcade game. But apparently someone discovered that not only are those tracks in the game, but the entire AX game is in the game. You just have to get like one of those like Game Genie things or whatever, where you like type in numbers and it'll unlock
it. And a GameCube.
On a GameCube.
Are
you playing the game now in some way on Wii U or something? Or
No, I mean...
You're just nostalgically...
Just nostalgically remembering it. And I watched a lot of YouTube videos of it today. Just like reminiscing. You know. Oh, yeah. Man. And that the guy that was playing it on YouTube, real good. He was like a pro at snaking, which is a... If you've played any of the recent Mario Kart games, you probably know how to snake.
I assume it's like draft. Drifting,
sort of like bounding or? In an old first-person shooter.
Yeah, actually, that's the perfect way of... because when you drift, you actually get a speed boost, so it's like exploiting that game system where you're just drifting left and right really rapidly. So that's why they call it snaking, because...
got it.
You get,
Serpentine.
Yeah, and oh, man, that game is so... And so, yeah, the fact that AX, the entire game is in there, like...
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, now I'm like, I have like, oh, shit,
It's so weird there would be so many years later, like, oh... Here's a little surprise.
Yeah, so I'm like, I have to find my GameCube, you know, get my Wavebirds out and buy that Game Genie thing and just, like, relive AX.
That's severe dedication right there. Sure that is the true warrior for F-Zero.
Well, because Nintendo's, I mean, you know, I'm sorry, F-Zero fans, but there will never be another F-Zero game as good as that ever again. So
the F-Zero warrior, and he's also the sad F-Zero warrior. He's like sort of the broken F-Zero warrior.
Well, I mean, because Amusement Visions, they closed down. Yeah. So, you know, there's just no more games coming from them. And I don't think Nintendo can make a proper F-Zero game in-house. So, I don't know. Maybe on Wii U.
That
who
would
knows?
Be pretty incredible. Next gen. I mean, that would be announcement.
Honestly,
they will try to make one.
Yeah.
They went through an entire generation without making an F-Zero game. So, anyway.
There you go.
That's my
slam dance.
Slam dance. My slam dance is, holy cow, Jeff's success notwithstanding. Kickstarter is a weird, woolly, broken thing, and it's really broken because of things like this. So it's a comparison of two different stories for games in the past week on and their fates on Kickstarter. On the one hand, we have In Exile Entertainment, and if you're not familiar with In Exile, these are the folks who, you know, recently brought you Hunted. You remember Hunted, right? Hunted the Demon's Forge in 2011.
Oh, yeah, again, I wanted to make sure Hunted the Demon's Forge.
Yeah, wasn't there Hunted the Reckoning or something?
That was...
Something like that.
Hunted Judgment. Yeah. Hunted Ascension.
There were Hunter games, which were back in the day. They were those. That was, one of them was made by the Collective. Anyway, that's a whole other series. Actually, one of the Hunter the Reckoning games was really cool. This was Hunted, the Demon's Forge, which was a two-player co-op game, and it was, you know, swords and sorceries built in the Unreal Engine. And it's so bad that In Exile has expunged it from its website.
You mean they put that game in exile?
They put that game in exile.
Snaps.
So this is Brian Fargo and those guys, and there's a lot of love for them and a lot of expectations. In fact, there's so much love that within a few hours, they set a new Kickstarter record, raising over $1 million in 6 hours. They are now almost to $2 million for a game that they're pushing now called Torment.
Wow.
And they're evoking the spirit of Planescape Torment, which is one of the most beloved role-playing games. And if you've never played Planescape Torment, then it's on Good Old Games. You should go play it right away. It is amazing and well worth, you know, dealing with the nostalgia of it. I mean the technical nostalgia play the game.
Right.
But like, they're evoking that. And what's really annoying to me is not only these guys' track record at the moment is it Hunted the Demon's Forge, but they also have Wasteland 2 already that they're making. So they already have a lot on their plate. And this game is not Planescape Torment. They're not making Planescape Torment. They're making some game called Torment that they want you to think has a lot to do with Planescape Torment, that has team members who worked on Planescape Torment, but is, quote unquote, we aren't focusing on a direct story or setting connection between the Planescape Torment story and Torment. This new game is set on a brand new RPG setting called Numenera. And the quick overview of that is that Numenera is a science fantasy role-playing game set in the far distant future where humanity lives amid the remnants of eight great civilizations that have risen and fallen on Earth. This is not anything to do with the Planescape world for D&D or Planescape Torment. And it frustrates me that these guys who already have Wasteland on their table, who have, like, for all the great intentions in the world of Brian Fargo and the stuff they've done before, really whiffed on Hunted the Demon's Forge, suddenly get these millions of dollars because there's so much pent-up love for Planescape.
Well, that's so... What's striking me is Double Fine had that amazing Kickstarter thing, made less money in that amount of time.
Yeah.
And yet, Double... To me, I mean, how were they able to get this money? I mean, like, I'd never heard... I mean...
They're able to get that
I'm
much
not
money
anyone, but...
Because there are so many people who would love to see more Planescape Torment.
Really? It's
so
that,
Planescape
it's
Torment
like
is legendary status.
Wow.
And the fact that there are people who worked on Planescape Torment and are involved with the project is enough to get a lot of people excited. But I'm just saying cautionary tale, folks. And I'm not mad. I mean, I would love to... That sounded too negative. Let me like retrace steps here a little bit.
I think you're more.
It's not that
it could happen.
I'm not upset with them that they're making. I think it's awesome they're going to make this, and the world sounds cool and all that. I'm appalled by the fact that like they would get so much money thrown at them, and yet Phosphor Games, who had an amazing looking in-game engine prototype for Project Awaken, couldn't get $500,000 for the entire run of their Kickstarter. It's unbelievable to me. These guys have been working with Epic on Unreal Engine 4. They demoed, they showed videos of in-game prototypes of incredibly cool stuff. This is a sort of like roll your own superhero Infamous on super steroids game that showed incredible potential, really beautiful looking stuff in Unreal Engine. It was gonna be really, you know, high-end stuff. These guys have just recently finished Horn on the iPad, so they clearly know how to spin the Unreal Engine and create a project that's, you know, top tier. They're working with Epic on the Unreal Engine, and they can't get $500,000 to do this game.
I think the frustrating, it's not necessarily the gameplay or whatever, but the frustrating aspect of it is that, you know, one Kickstarter is just promising a lot without actually showing anything.
Yeah.
Versus another one.
That's exactly it. And I'm just like, these guys, they had this thing and they're showing, and it's like, how this is why Kickstarter's become so broken, because it had such promise to be this great opportunity for bootstrapping indie projects and getting past that hump of getting development into a state where it could go forward. And a project like Torment, in all honesty, In Exile didn't need to bring that to... I mean, they brought other games, and I realized, but these big games that come into Kickstarter that don't necessarily need... that could be shopped as real publisher games... they really make it difficult, because now it's like, yeah, if you're a $500,000 game, how do you get anyone interested? Because, by the way, it's the world of the, you know, $2 million games now on Kickstarter. Or Jeff Cannata's new show.
That's all right.
Which you should contribute to. All right, Dan, thanks very much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll have to keep up with your schedule. I'd love to have you back.
Yeah.
I would like to have you back here at the same time Cannata's here.
I agree.
That'd be amazing.
I love that.
We could synchronize that somehow.
Yes.
Also want to give a shout to Drew Polson. Drew, I am very sorry we had your question you sent in to us right here ready to go. I will hold it over for next week's show. We just got running long and talking about a bunch of stuff. Dave's been squawking in my ear for like the last 10 minutes that you're over time. So. But we're not on radio anyway, so we can go over time as long as we want. And thank you very much, of course, to Brooklyn back in the booth for us on the dials and slides and all that kind of stuff. And Dave, thanks for not doing the calendar right. He's not going to say anything. He's like, thumbs up. All right. All right, ready? Jeff will be back next week, as will I. And until next week, we are Ghost. That's your weekend confirmed. Work so hard, but you know we play harder. Work so hard, don't you know we play harder. To see what was going down, my body's vibrating, pulsating to the sound. Hey, bartender, hit me with another round. I gotta finish, she's ready. This episode of Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers, with info on over 50,000 console, handheld, iOS, and PC games. Get the Gamefly app for free today on your iPhone, iPad, and Android devices.